We are using Zoom for this electronic meeting. All members of the board have the ability to communicate contemporaneously during this meeting through this platform, and the public has access to the contemporaneously listen and, if necessary, participate in this meeting through website education.nh.gov/who-we-are/State Board of Education (2020) State Board Meetings (all hyphenated). And I believe there's also a call-in number. It is 1-301-715-8592. We previously gave notice to the public of the necessary information for accessing the meeting, including how to access the meeting using Zoom or telephonically. Instructions have also been provided on the website that I just previously mentioned. If anybody has a problem, please call. Angela, what's the number they should call? You're muted.
I know, I just noticed that. 603-271-3144.
Okay, and they can email you at what address?
angela.adams@doe.nh.gov.
All right, in the event the public is unable to access the meeting will be adjourned and rescheduled. Please note that all votes that are taken during the meeting shall be done by roll call vote. And we will start by taking roll call attendance. So over to you, Angela.
Okay, so Sally Griffin, if you could just state that you're here, where you're located, and if anybody is with you.
Okay. Selena Griffin present, and I'm at my home in Guilford, New Hampshire. And I am alone in this room. My husband is in the home, but we're not in the same room.
Okay. Ann Lane?
I am at my home in Dover, New Hampshire, and I'm in my office with periodically two four-legged creatures.
Kate Cassidy? You have to unmute Kate.
Sorry, too many computers on at the same time. I'm here in my office all by myself. Lindsay's in the second office.
Helen Honorill?
I'm in Nashua, New Hampshire, in my office with my door closed.
All right, Drew Klein.
I am in the State Board of Education meeting room by myself.
And I guess I'll say I'm at my home in Thornton by myself and one four-legged friend.
All right. Okay, so shall we do the pledge?
Yes.
I'm going to put my camera on the flag. All right.
Well, that'd be cool.
I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America,
and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All righty. All right. So we have public comment here. Angela, are we still just doing written public comment?
Yes, it's we are. It's just too unwieldy to try to coordinate who wants to speak at which. We do have some folks, though, that are signed up for the public hearing, and we'll get that list shortly. If anybody does have any public comment, if they could email it to me, I'd be happy to share with the board, as well as post it with the public materials that we have posted on the link that we just provided.
We had three people listed as public comment attendees, but I'm not sure if that's public comment or public hearing.
It's for the hearing, I'm pretty sure.
I'm checking on that just to make sure that people are signed up for the hearing and not for public comment. I know at least one of them is for the hearing. I think they all are. I'm going to just close this door. I'm getting some outside noise. Sorry for that. Okay, so these are all for, actually for the public hearing, so we're good to go. Okay, first up, we have comprehensive support and improvement school presentations. We have Christine Brennan, Mike Schwartz, Jess Miller. You guys up?
Yes, we are, Drew. Good morning. Good
morning.
We're glad to have you here. We're glad to be here today. And we wanted to, you'll see that the CSI schools are on our agenda for the next couple of months. And I really think it's a great opportunity for the board to see the leaders that are in the schools right now, especially during COVID times. Mike's going to give us an overview of what the CSI schools are and the ways that our principal leaders are coming up with ways to improve the schools and the test scores. And right now we have Chase Miller from Nashua, and he is the teacher of the year at his school, Danielle Bruton, which is very exciting. And we also have Paula Jones, who's from Wilson Elementary School, my old school. So that makes me proud. This is her first year as a principal leader. And I really think it's a great opportunity for the board to recognize how these leaders are implementing many of the changes, and especially during COVID time. They've developed some plans. They've had to alter their plans. And I think they're true heroes right now. One of the things that the commissioner expressed when making their plans to improve was that they could be as innovative and creative as possible. You know, break down the walls and think creatively. And I think that you'll see some of that in their plans, and they're very willing to answer any of your questions. So without further ado, I'm going to have Mike Schwartz talk about demonstrated success, their role, and what CSI schools are. So thank you very much for this opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. And this is Mike Schwartz. I want to thank the Chairperson Klein, board members, and the Commissioner for having us, giving us time to come speak to you about the CSI schools. I want to thank the Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner for feeling like this is an important enough issue to bring to you and to keep in front of you in terms of sharing their work. We think there's really two very valuable purposes to this discussion. One is to help these schools share the hard work they're doing. They are working extremely hard, these CSI schools, and it's wonderful to let them tell you about some of the work they're doing. And then certainly from an accountability perspective, it's certainly helpful for these schools to know that they're accountable and they're here to tell you about the hard work they're doing to turn around their schools. You should have packets in your packets. You should have some presentations that we put together, both what I'm going to be talking about with the Deputy Commissioner in terms of an overview, as well as the specific presentations from the two schools. I'm going to spend about 5 to 10 minutes at most talking about what is CSI, what is ESSA, just to make sure you all have kind of a context for all of this. And then we'll turn it over to Chaz Miller, who's the principal of Ledge Street School, a wonderful principal, as well as Paula Jones, also a wonderful principal from the Wilson Elementary School. And our plan is that we'll each talk again for 5 to 10 minutes, and then after each presentation, give you a chance to ask questions. But you know, we understand this is your meeting, so stop us anytime as you see fit. As the deputy said, these are the CSI schools, and so there is the ESSA, the federal legislation, the Every Student Succeeds Act, and it was defined in 2015 to identify how our state's going to hold their schools accountable for achievement of students, the ESSA plan was the New Hampshire then put together their ESSA plan in 2017, and it's what's called our consolidated plan, and it identifies exactly how we're going to hold schools accountable. comes up with indicators and determines the plan on what schools have to do if they are not performing for their students. The consolidated plan is on the department's website. There's a URL in the presentation. So by all means, take a look at that. And if you ever have any questions now or later, I'm more than happy to help talk through that consolidated plan. The plan that the department put together to meet the federal accountability regulations identifies three categories of schools, and this is similar across the country. There are what's called CSI, or Comprehensive Support and Improvement Schools. And the CSI schools are the schools that are really struggling the most in the state in terms of academic achievement for their students. So it's the bottom 5% of schools in the state in terms of academic achievement, and I'll talk about how that's measured in a few minutes. And so for, it's Title I schools that we focus on, so those receiving federal funds. So for elementary, and that's really what our focus is today, there are 12 schools, so 5% of the lowest performing schools in the state translates to 12 schools. We'll show you a slide with those in just a minute, or I'll talk about those in just a minute. Those are schools who, across the entire student population, they're struggling in their achievement. There are also in the ESSA plan what's called ATS and TSI schools. ATS is additional targeted support, and TSI is targeted support and improvement. Both ATS and TSI are schools that have a subgroup that are struggling. So it might be their special education subgroup. In most cases, it is their special education subgroup. It could be their free and reduced students, so the students who come from lower income housing homes. It could be their English language learners. So ATS and TSI are when you've got a school that has a subgroup that's struggling. For the most part, the primary, for at least from a funding support level, it goes to the CSI schools. ATS and TSI schools are identified, but they are working on their own to develop their own plans. Indicators that are used to determine whether a school is a CSI or any of these ATS, any of these struggling schools, there are four indicators for elementary schools. Those include achievement. So the primary indicator we're going to look at is what percentage of the students were proficient on the state assessment test. You'll find in many of these struggling schools that it may be in the single digits. You may have less than 10% of the kids who are able to achieve proficiency on the state assessment. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done to help these students achieve, improve in their achievement. And the second indicator that's used to determine whether a school's struggling or not is growth. So one of the indicators put together in this plan was this idea of measuring or monitoring growth of students. And so it's important that regardless of whether you are a school that has kids that are struggling in achievement, or if you're a school that has has kids who are proficient, you still want to make sure that those schools are growing their students. Their students are growing in terms of their academic learning. So the second indicator is growth, and that's vital to determine which schools are in the lowest 5%. English language proficiency is the third indicator. So if you've got a large English language learning group within your school, that is an indicator that's used to determine how your school's doing. And then the final one is school quality. There's an equity index that looks primarily at students who are struggling and looks at how you're really focusing on those lowest performing students within your school, and are you helping them grow. So those four indicators are used to determine which schools are struggling the most in the state. At the high school level,
I'm sorry. Do you want us to put up the presentation for you? I didn't know you had that ability on your share. Does Commissioner you or Angela?
I have it up on mine, Christine.
Mike, I've enabled screen sharing if you need to use that.
Okay, sure.
Thanks.
Are you seeing it now?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes.
So thanks. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. So these are in your handouts as well. So these are the indicators that I was just talking through, the academic achievement, the growth in EL, English language proficiency, and school quality. On the high school, it's similar characteristics, growth and achievement, ELP. The fourth one is focused on college and career readiness, so it looks at graduation rate. As I mentioned before, there are 12 elementary schools that are identified as the lowest performing based on these characteristics. And I can tell you, for the most part, it really comes down to achievement and growth. Although ELP and school quality did have an impact maybe for one or two schools, for the majority, those lowest 5% are based on their growth and their achievement. At the high school level, there's really, if you look at that 5% of Title I high schools, it really is only one high school that's identified based on these four characteristics. But in fact, there are eight high schools that are identified as struggling, because in addition to these four, the other indicator that's used is to make sure that high schools have at least a 67% graduation rate within 4 and 5 years. And there are about 7 schools that didn't meet that threshold. It should be noted that of those 7 schools, many are charter schools, and those charter schools, most of those charter schools, their mission is to help students who are struggling. So by definition, they're going to have kids that are taking longer to graduate. So they're identified, but it should be understandable that they're identified because they're really serving that population of students who do take longer to graduate. All these schools, I'll talk about in a minute, receive support. And it's wonderful that even those charter schools can receive some support because they frequently don't get that extra type of support. These are the 12 elementary schools. And so today, as I mentioned earlier, Wilson and Ledge will be presenting. And then we've got the other schools lined up. Assuming this seems to be effective and valuable both for you and schools, we'll continue to come back with these schools so they can present their work as we go forward. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about the support and monitoring that goes on in these schools. The number one thing, or one of the most important things within these schools to create this change is the school leadership. And so each one of these schools has a strong principal with a really strong leadership team behind them. And Chaz and Paula both have leadership teams of, you know, 4 or 5 folks who are working with them closely in developing their plans to implement change. And so that leadership team is certainly one of the most important supports within their school. The state also provides support, so the state offers funding, and so you'll see in their presentations there's the amount of funds they received last year and this year is included in one of their slides. But the state does provide additional funding for these schools, and there's also the oversight. So the title groups within the Department of Education provide oversight to make sure that these schools and the way that the grants that these schools are requesting, or the way they're requesting to use their funds, that those align with creating change within their schools. Demonstrated success. So the company I work for, our company is providing technical support. So we are helping the schools develop their improvement plans. We have pulled together a group of principal and leader mentors that are working with these principals within their schools, their leaders within their schools, to help give them some guidance. These are experienced principals and leaders that we brought in. We have some special education and English language learner expertise that we're bringing in where it's fitting based on the school needs. And then we pull together some instructional professional development, and we bring these schools together to help them collaborate amongst each other in their improvement effort. And we also have a leadership course that these 3 or 4 folks from each one of these schools are going to be going through. And then finally, to monitor the improvement and to guide the improvement, the schools have developed their what's called an SIP, or school improvement plan. And typically the schools have 2 to 3 goals that they're working on over the course of a year or two. It's important the schools stay focused on some significant goals. I can say that one important thing to keep in mind is that one large goal for many of these schools is just an improved culture, setting higher expectations from the teachers, creating collaborative and working groups to move their efforts forward. So their SIP goals are certainly one use of both support and monitoring those goals. Those plans have detailed measurements of how they're going to monitor that success. Also, WestEd, many of you are familiar with, is a vendor that's come in, and they actually are doing some monitoring of these schools. They have what they call a call survey. And the call survey is a series of perception measurements that are used to get a better handle on how the school's operating and where the gaps may be. And so you'll see actually in the presentations that were handed out for these schools, you'll see their call survey results. And there's some significant improvement from the first year to the second year already. And then finally, the last kind of monitoring or measurement tool is obviously the student academic achievement. So the state assessment test is used to identify whether these schools are improving. Most of the plans are not focused solely on the test results. They're focused on changing systems within the schools. But certainly the assessment results is a key factor, and schools have to show improvement 2 years in a row to leave the CSI process. So with Mike, that.
Before we can move on, we have a member who has a question, I believe. So I'm going to go to Ellen.
Yes. Thank you. Mike, when you mentioned the charter schools were contributing to those numbers in the high school, are they given a look to see whether those students are graduating within, so long as they're staying in our schools, including whether they're staying past 18, or whether they are participating in any of the credit recovery and opportunities to get a diploma after they leave a school?
So thanks for the question, and I'm gonna give you a short answer, and then I'm gonna also turn it over to the commissioner, deputy commissioner. So our focus really has been on elementary schools, and so I'm gonna tell you. The two things I can tell you is one, the federal regulation requires the state to use a 4 and 5 year graduation rate to identify which schools are. So that isn't really an option. However, okay. Schools clearly are doing, at least from my perception, the schools are doing a very good job at students who typically drop out, stay in school and eventually get a degree. And I know that there's a charter academy and some other things that the commissioner's, I believe is in, he's championing around helping them get college credit and keeping them moving forward. I don't know.
Thank you.
So I'm going to turn it over. Before I turn it over, I just want to say a couple of things about Ledge and Wilson. And I also want to say, you know, I could talk for hours about this stuff. I know you don't have hours. So I went through this fairly quickly. And by all means, even after this meeting, please reach out to me. I'm happy to meet one-on-one or give you more information. So in a minute, you're going to hear from Chaz Miller. Chaz is the principal of Ledge Street School. Chaz has been there, I believe, for this is his third year now. He is a dynamic, amazing leader. He's done such a good job at building a culture within that school, a culture that really is very focused on social emotional learning for the students as well as their academic learning. We believe in supporting all these schools that the type of leadership that we've seen that Chaz is providing is central to developing a strong school that can really help these students. Paula Jones is brand new to New Hampshire, so be kind to her. She just started in Wilson this past September, but she started with like a race car on a track in a good controlled manner. She's doing a great job at building very needed positive leadership in that school. They've had quite a transition in the past couple of years of leaders, and there's nothing more important, at least I believe, in that school to have the type of leadership that Paul's providing in setting very high expectations, in building ownership, accountability, but also collaboration among her teachers who feel a part of the school. So the stuff she's doing, I think, is really going to turn into success for the students. Both these schools have, you know, some challenging populations of students that they're really doing a great job at setting some high expectations to help those students grow. So I should stop. I'm going to turn it over to them. But by all means, if there's any other questions, or Deputy Commissioner, Commissioner, if you want to add anything else before they go on, please do that as well.
Thank you, Mike.
So I guess I'll control the screen then if you want to.
Great. Sounds good. I actually have my presentation here. So if I'm looking down, it's because I scribbled some notes to try to keep within the time frame. Like you said, Mike, I could talk for hours about Ledge Street Elementary. So I'll try. Brevity is good here. I'd like to thank everyone, first of all, for this morning. First of all, I think I'd like to start every day with that announcement that Mike just said. I think I'd be a pretty happy guy if I was complimented like that every morning. So what a great start to the day. But a serious thank you to, you know, the commissioner's office and the DOE and this state, the way it thinks about education. I've worked in North Carolina and I've worked in Washington State. And this is the first state that I've worked in where really from the highest echelons of education, what's come down is you're a CSI school. Because I've always worked in schools that receive title funds, but the schools here are encouraged to take advantage of opportunity. And it's not so much where's your test score. That's important, obviously. The data is important and moving that data is important. But one of the things that I've taken away from being in this state is that innovation and opportunity is in this time. Take advantage of it. And that creates excitement and all kinds of amazing things. So thank you for giving us as principals that autonomy and that leeway to really talk with our staffs in that manner, because it charges up teachers, it charges up administrators, it charges up kids, and it really is going to be a dynamic thing that grows throughout the year. So thank you very much for that. I'm going to go through the slides. So the data ones I probably won't talk about too much. I don't want to have death by PowerPoint or anything with people here, but we're a larger school. I'll pretty much say is we're a larger school. We're usually up over 500, but we're about 499. Racially, culturally diverse school. I've only worked in racially and culturally diverse schools throughout my entire career as a principal, and it just adds a richness to everything that we do. And it's just an amazing vibrance that happens through that diversity. So it's something that we and I personally try to take advantage of within our school and have our students show who they are and what they can do based on their, you know, diverse racial and cultural background. So that's a big part of what we do. Here. We do have a large ELL population, about a third of our school, so many of our students struggle with the language, which means we have to think very intently as we go forward with initiatives, things like that. We have to make sure that all of our strategies, all of our PD, things like that, first and foremost, focuses on assisting students who do not speak the language or who struggle teaching the language. And the great news is anything that we do for students who struggle with the language benefits every single student in the school. And so we're really looking at there first and then moving forward. So what we're proud of, I'll start off first and foremost, Christine started here, you know, could not be happier. I mean, over the moon happy that Daniel Booten has been recognized in the state for the amazing work that she's done. She is an educator who, you know, and I think she's very unique to somebody who I've worked with, and she just has humility and shows vulnerability, and she's progressive and she's innovative. She's everything that needs to happen in a school like ours to be a teacher leader. And so excited she's getting recognized. The great thing is, though, that she's not the only rock star we have. And I do, and I'm going to predict in front of everybody here today, she's not the last teacher you're going to hear from at Ledge Street Elementary, that there are many more in the pipeline, that as we go forward and as we continue to innovate and all that, there's going to be many more teachers from Ledge that get on people's radar. So really excited about that. Over the past couple years, one of the things coming in, Ledge has had an interesting past a bit. There's been some turmoil. And when I came in a couple years ago, one thing that I knew is that there needed to be healing. There needed to be healing with the staff. There needed to be healing with the community. And there needed to be trust built. And what we decided to do, and I talked to the staff my first few days in, is that vulnerability and humility and failing forward is important. It's important we all make that a fabric of our school culture, because innovation cannot happen if we don't fail forward, if we don't accept that I'm going to make a mistake and then I'm going to adjust it and go to something different. If I'm not vulnerable, if I don't put myself out there as a teacher, then I'm not going to change. It's just not going to happen. So vulnerability is really important. And then me as a leader modeling that as soon as I walked in the door, modeling vulnerability, modeling failing forward. It gives the staff the authority, the feeling of, well, if he's going to do that, if he's going to fail forward, you know what? I can do it too. And I'm going to try these things. And that's when innovation happens. And what I've seen is that has set up this great, just this great ball. I guess I think about it as a big boulder rolling down a hill that's all of a sudden picked up a ton of steam, as it's now commonplace within our school that teachers talk with each other in a vulnerable manner. Oh man, I really need help with this. Can you help me? That as administration and teacher leaders, we talk about the things, wow, that didn't work, kind of failed at that. But you know what? Here's what I'm doing next. And that has become commonplace, and it's really charged up our change. And you're going to see that as you go to, I'm going to skip over the slide where we were identified. Mike kind of went over that already a little bit. But if you go to our call survey comparison, if you look at that change, excuse me, and all those arrows that are pointing up, and the significant change that happened in the last year, that's because we have a staff now that has really charged itself up with, I'm okay having what I'm going to call emotional intelligence, which is we work with people. We don't make tires. We're not, people who go out and make other things, whatever. We work within people. and around people. And so the very first thing we have to do is understand emotional intelligence and understand when I'm talking to somebody or I'm listening to somebody, I need to do these things so that we all talk together and we all pull together and we all learn together. So this vulnerability and this humility and this failing forward that's a part of our culture has accelerated our change in a way that I think has showed up on here. And I've been super excited that the data is showing what we're doing. And it's really become a platform. So these past 2 years, we worked very hard to, again, build trust, put in the vulnerability, put in the innovation, all that kind of stuff. And I think about it as like a house. So right now, the foundation has been laid. And now it's time for us to transition to really thinking about, let's think about what are we doing with instruction? How are we innovating with instruction? How are we innovating with working together as teams and talking with each other? Because with this foundation laid, we can just rocket off into outer space now. Everything is right in front of us now for the taking. And so when you go to our priority goals, we're focusing on two things. Tier one instruction, and we're focusing on PLCs, professional learning communities. Okay. So the way it, and I'm, it's funny because as I was going over this, I kind of saw a neat progression within this presentation that it kind of flowed pretty nicely. So out of this building of this culture comes teachers and students and people who want to all work together. And so now when, for instance, we're focusing on tier one instruction, which is just general instruction. So when you walk into a classroom and you look around, that's tier one instruction. It is vital that tier one instruction is efficient and effective because it's like that foundation of the house as well. Anything that is faulty in tier one instruction makes everything else rickety that you build on top of it. So tier two instruction, which would be teachers coming in for Title I services, things like that, or tier three instruction, which would be going to maybe exploring special education services, things like that. That's all built on the assumption that kids are learning in the regular ed classroom really efficiently, really effectively. And I've been at schools where that's snuck by. And when it does, kids really get the short end of the stick because they are, it can be like a bullet train sometimes if tier one instruction is not done well or done efficiently or effectively. Because then it's, oh, this kid's struggling, and it's like a bullet train to special ed. Or this kid's struggling, oh, it's a bullet train to Title I. We have to own that tier one instruction, and we have to make sure that's solid, because then we know when we have to refer somebody to Title I services or special ed, we've done everything we can, all the best practices. And in that, we're catching a bunch of kids who maybe in another system might have been tossed over to an intervention of some sort, we're actually getting them in the regular ed classroom. So, and that's always better. So we're working on that tier one instruction. We're focusing that tier one instruction on brain research. And, I don't think I have time to jump into it. It's hugely fascinating work. The teachers love it, but it's a matter of taking what we know now about all the brain research and putting it into these tried and true, strategies and best practices that are there. So it involves, very, very actively getting kids to turn and discuss, very actively talking to kids about what they're learning and why they're learning it and revisiting it, because your brain can only focus on one thing at a time. And we need to tell the kids, you need to focus on this thing. Here's what we're learning. If we don't tell them that, if we don't tell them this and tell them why, they'll be off in wherever land in their mind. So there's all these best practices that we're focusing on. But it's really methodical. We're working with the Burke Group. They're from Washington State. I worked with them a bit out there, and it's been great. Teachers have loved it. The brain research is amazing, and it's very engaging. So, and it's measurable. So we're measuring the work we're doing and how far we're coming with tier one instructions. That's great. And that goes into our PLCs, where we need to be talking about instruction. We need to be talking about what are the kids learning? What are they, how do we know that they've learned it? What do they do if they haven't learned it? And what do they do if they have learned it? But we need to formalize those conversations. It can't be teachers just getting together. We can't just put them in a room and say, okay, grade two, go ahead and work together. That doesn't work. There's got to be formalized norms. There's got to be formalized agendas. There's got to be notes. There's got to be activities to follow up with the group. So we're working on really formalizing those things. And again, both of those have been set up by the fact that we have a culture now where teachers and administrators are okay saying, well, that didn't work. Let's try this. Or, wow, I didn't really do that right. Can you help me on this? that is going to help charge up both of these things and really launch them forward. So I'm pretty excited about that. Going into the key challenges, they're related to those. Professional learning communities, we need to find time to do it. Time in the day is a wonderful pie. There's never any time added to my day. So we have to figure out when do we have these meetings, because they will be taking the place of something else. So we're in the process of talking as an instructional leadership team and as a school, when are we going to have these weekly meetings? So we're in the process of that. And then working towards more consistent implementation of, for instance, all of the Burke strategies. They're called Four Habits of Quality Instruction for Tier 1. And, you know, every minute of every day is an opportunity for us to continue working on the things we've learned. And fidelity matters. And we've been talking about that as a staff. So we're really getting into the mode, but we really need it to be the fabric of our culture to think, I've learned this, I'm putting it into place. Every minute of every day, I'm following through with it. So those are our two key challenges. And then our key successes that kind of wrap up here. One of them is our Soaring for Success document, which Mike alluded to at the beginning. There was a document that I created with a previous staff in Washington that I also brought here that outlines expectations for every area of the building, positive expectations, as in we will walk in the hallway with our hands to ourselves. We will use a calm voice when we're in the classroom, things like that. There's a whole document that is set up for parents, teachers, and students. So everybody who is in our school community has expectations set, positive expectations, for how this culture is going to be. And so I brought that document that I did at one of my previous schools and brought it here, and we kind of legitized it and brought it to our culture and climate team, and they've done an amazing job, amazing teacher leaders, to make this into a document that guides our entire school. And so it's been an amazing thing. It's about a 40-page document, but it's got everything that we could ever do. And if there ever is a living document that's 40 pages, this is it. Normally I'll say 40 pages and somebody will say it's too bloated. But this is actually a living document that we revisit and re-revise. It's quite amazing. And then the last thing, it's been tough in this COVID time to really figure out what does rigorous instruction look like. And at Ledge, we started so many great things over the past year and a half, and then COVID hit. We had to figure out a way to make sure we continue this and we don't lose that steam of what we've got and that ability to keep rolling that rock, that boulder down the hill. And so one of the things is with guided reading, it's really hard, even though we have RAS Kids and some other things online where kids can access books, it's hard for teachers to continue guided reading, like small group reading, with students while they're at home. But what we've done is I've set up mobile-leveled book room. So every grade level, every teacher chooses leveled books for their kids, which are the leveled readers that they use for kids as they move through their reading instruction. And those are different than library books. I'm not sure if you all know. You probably do know what leveled books are, but they're different than library books in that they have very specific wording in them based on a certain level. And as kids learn, they go up to different levels in the books, and it's very fluid. But the kids didn't have those books, and there's just nothing that replaces a book in somebody's hand when they're reading and during that reading instruction. So it's about every other week we actually get books out to the kids, and then the kids come back and they exchange it, and we give them another one, and they're on these level book carts that I have. So we've been able to actually continue reading instruction by giving teachers and parents what they need to go. And this is a part of a bigger initiative that I'd like to do. And back when I was a principal in North Carolina, another principal and I actually put, we used Title I funds and had satellite leveled book rooms at churches and at community centers so that a child on an ordinary Tuesday night, they could go out and get a leveled book and bring it home to work with. And that connected instruction at home with instruction at a school in a way that was just, it was just mind blowing. It was incredible. And it was incredible seeing the culture of kids. Now, libraries are great and kids still should go to libraries. But again, the books they get there might have words they can read, words they can't read. This was something that was directly related to their instruction, and the kids loved it. They would go home with a book that they knew they could read to their parents or their grandmother or their grandfather, their sister. And so when COVID ends, we are going to go move towards that. I've already got some churches lined up, a Boys and Girls Club right next door, and we're going to create this and make this so. So we're really excited about where that's going to go to. So I think I went probably way over my time, Mike. I apologize for that. But again, just really excited, thankful that I'm able to share this. If anybody has any questions, obviously feel free to let me know.
Thanks, Chaz. That was really, really good. I think really informative for us.
Are there any other questions? If not, we'll turn it over to Paula. And Paula, I'm going to have to apologize up front for putting you after Chaz. Paula has been fantastic. And she, as I mentioned earlier, this is her first year in New Hampshire. She's come over the border from Massachusetts. She got smart and said this is where she needs to come. And she is doing such a great job in terms of creating a few different things, high expectations for her teachers. But a sense of support and collaboration from her leadership team that I think is really going to go a long way in building what hopefully will be more retention within her school for her staff and staff that really feel good about the environment there. So with that, I'll turn it to Paula.
Thanks, Mike. And I actually want to thank you for putting Chaz first because it gave me a fast forward into what the next 2 years could potentially look like for us, and he explained so much that I'm going to be able to buzz right through. So thank you, Chaz. I appreciate it. So thank you for having me today. Thank you for allowing me to present here today. This is a career first for me. So I was very excited when I woke up at 5 a.m. this morning. My husband was not so happy when I told him how excited I was at 5 a.m. this morning. But thank you for having me. So Mike was right. I was hired on September 1st. It was my first day, so I have hit the ground running and trying to just do the best we can with these times, but I'm super excited to be here. So a little bit about who we are here at Henry Wilson. Very similar demographic to what Chaz shared with you. I have about 432 students at this point. And again, you can see our breakdown there in front of you. I won't spend time talking to you about that, but I will say, we are very fortunate here to have levels of support unlike I've ever seen in any elementary school I've ever worked in. I'm fortunate to have 4 English language teachers. I'm fortunate to have 4 special education teachers. I'm fortunate to have full-time Title I teachers. So just know that this funding that this school has been provided out of Title I money and CSI funding has been crucial in the hiring process and crucial in getting what we need here at Henry Wilson. So that said, I'm going to tell you some things that we're really proud of. We, as Mike has said, we have a like-minded leadership team that's really committed to this work and wants to move the school forward. And I could say that even permeates further into the staff at this school. The staff that are currently here want to be here, want to make a difference, want to instill best practice in classrooms. So that's half of a battle that I don't have to fight, which is wonderful. We're working towards the biggest thing I noticed when I came here on September 1st is that we have a lot of resources available to us, and everyone was kind of working singularly in within the walls of their classroom, and I'm trying to instill this message of we all need to work together. We're much better as a team. Don't close your door and teach in a silo. We need to be open and honest and have these conversations, as Chaz was talking about, with each other. But I found that a lot of people weren't faithful to one curriculum. So the very first thing I did is using the research-based knowledge that I have coming from many years of being an instructional coach and a first and second grade teacher and an administrator and say, this is the program we're going to use for reading. This is the curriculum we're going to use for writing. This is the curriculum we're going to use for our social emotional learning. And this is what we're going to be faithful to. We can't be all over the place trying something different every other week or not having consistency. And we're also, the other thing we're also doing is that we're working on strengthening our community outreach and family engagement. I can't do this job without families being involved, which COVID presents, you know, a tough thing for that. How do I, as a new principal, get out and introduce myself, right? And normally I would have had a parent night. That can't happen. So I've been doing Zoom calls on a monthly basis with families, inviting everybody to come. Last month we did one with mental health was the topic. And I'm hoping to grow that every single month. I'm working with community partners. My social worker is very connected in the community, so working with the Manchester Department of Public Health and things like that. So I'm really excited about that. And my staff here is definitely dedicated to supporting the social emotional well-being of students as well as their academic needs. We are using Choose Love as our social emotional curriculum for those of you that may or may not be familiar. And we're finding, you know, when I go into classrooms either in person or I join a Google Classroom every day, I see techniques being taught to kids that's going to you know, fuel up their social emotional health, because some of them have been stuck in their houses for almost 8 months now, and it's tough. It's really tough. So doing that. On the next slide is just what Mike already talked about. It's the why we are identified as a CSI school, but you can see the funding allocation there down at the bottom, that we receive a significant amount of funds from CSI, and we also are a Title I school. So we receive significant amounts there. The call survey, which is new to me, coming from Massachusetts, I can say that even though it looks a little bit different than Chaz's, right, in his 2020 column, all the arrows were blue because he was above the state average. You can see here at Wilson, they're all still in the red. But I will note in the change column that although we are below the state averages, we did see positive change. So I'm hopeful that that can keep trending up in the right direction with all the things we have going on. Our goals, similar to Chaz's, it's like we're mirroring in each other. We are, you know, moving towards this fidelity to curriculum. So that first goal is all about the fidelity to the curriculum, because if we're faithful to the curriculum and we're teaching it with fidelity, with best practice in mind, we are going to see students improve. It's just, that's the research. So that's what that goal is about and what we're using to do those things. And then we are talking about family participation. I told you that one of the things we're going to try and do is to increase that. So how we're going to do that is Wilson staff members getting involved, monthly Zoom calls, I went on home visits with my social worker last week to try and get to, you know, connect with families that way. So just getting out into the community. And then the last thing that we're focusing on is we're lucky we have an MTSS coach at the district level, and she's working. We're piloting with her this year, trying to move the school forward. We had a PBIS system when I came in, and we're trying to move towards that MTSS model with those really solid best practices happening in tier one, so that we don't have the fast train to an IEP or Title I services, so that we're making sure things are happening in classrooms every single day to do that. And then some of the challenges we face here at Henry Wilson. This is probably one of my favorite expressions that I picked up from our superintendent, Dr. Goldhart, is that we really need to change the mindset of staff from seeing students as at risk, meaning that potential for failure, to at promise for success. I think that's something that's so important. This will come with the collective efficacy and the attitude that these are all of our students, right? It's not, this is my student and the reading specialist is going to fix it, and then they're going to come back to me and know how to read. It's what's that collective effort that we have for all of our students. Another challenge is that we have really high caseloads for our special educators, which make it really difficult to give your due diligence to each student. And also we have in this building a lack of paraprofessional support that we're constantly trying to hire and maintain high quality staff. In the past, because I'm going to say here publicly that with hopefully me coming on and having a strong leadership team, that the high teacher turnover and administration turnover will stop. I have a long-term plan for this building, and I hope to stay here long enough to see that through, and I want to be here for the staff and the students. So the last thing is one of our challenges is utilizing specific resources in regards to curriculum consistency, which I've already begun to address, but it definitely is, with many resources, a challenge that we see. So that said, in this short time, we have seen some success. We have had the staff training with the Ready Classroom and math curriculum. Everybody, as I told you, is implementing Choose Love Social Emotional Learning. We have consistency among the leadership team in vision and curriculum planning. Then I made a unified schedule and laid out curriculum expectations right from the beginning so that everybody knows when, how long to teach math, to teach reading, to teach writing, and that, you know, what curriculum to use to do so. And we have the supports in place for professional development because we had about 15 new staff this year. And then we're working with a district coach to implement MTSS with fidelity. So all of that said, I have to say, and the other thing we did was we're working on a 90-day equity plan. So from these goals, we'll chunk it out into 90-day segments, and then we create a look-for document that when we go into classrooms, we can quickly say, this is happening, we're moving forward, and we'll continue to do that. We'll make 2 to 3 of those this year alone. So I think that's it for me. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Thank you for letting us take the time to share our excitement about our schools with you.
Paula, this is Drew Klein. Thank you so much. That was really great. I have a question just for clarification on a point you made under priority goals. The second bullet point is that by June of next year, You'll have 100% of teachers at level 3 or greater in fidelity to curriculum and implementation of differentiated small group instruction. Can you just expand on what that means? Do you have teachers that, what does level 3 mean and what sort of training are they behind in? I just want to understand that better.
Yeah, so when we say level 3, we decided that we would, in our look for document, have these different levels, that it would be like 1 through 4, and that as we went through and checked, that we would be able to say with fidelity that they were implementing with fidelity the curriculum, and that they would be doing it with the best practices in tier 1 practices in place. So that really will come from building walkthroughs, from my walkthroughs, from the assistant principal's walkthroughs, from instructional coaches being in classrooms every day. And then, making sure, yes, there's professional development. We do something called the Wilson Academy, which is done after school. It's voluntary, but many, many staff attend, and it could be professional development on implementing Lucy Calkins writing workshop. It could be professional development on how to use Google Classroom. It could be professional development on any plethora of curriculum things we have going on. I can't be in every classroom every minute of the day, so this was a great way to build in that layer and level of accountability for each staff member to be faithful to curriculum.
So, and just to follow up, how common is it, and I'm just trying to understand, how common is it for teachers to not be faithful to the curriculum? Is it a tiny percentage? Is it a fairly large percentage? Just in your experience.
I can only answer for this building. And what I gathered from what I could gather, I would say it was probably 50 to 60%,
really?
Not faithful to one particular curriculum. So you could have had one classroom using something that, Manchester Public Schools had put out, which is wonderful, right? It's a quality curriculum document, like for writing workshop. And then you could have someone next door who wasn't using that at all and kind of gone rogue. And so what does that do if you have 2 second grade classrooms and one's teaching one with fidelity and one's teaching kind of whatever they want? That doesn't work for kids. That doesn't make kids successful. So by saying to teachers, we will use Fountas and Pinnell's guided reading, we will use Choose Love for this. It took that, and some of it I think came with just guesswork of what are we doing. And then I think some of it comes from, administrators not being fully present potentially. So for me, getting into classrooms every single day, right, making sure that I can put on my coaching hat and make sure that I'm in classrooms, I'm hearing the dialogue, I'm seeing where the pacing is at, helps me help staff stay accountable for that.
Yeah, and just to follow up, I don't want to belabor too much, but I'm just really curious how it works, because we've had administrators tell us over the last few years that how important leadership is to keeping a focus on things like curriculum. And so A, I'm just sort of curious. I know the teachers have a lot of leeway in curriculum, but how does it actually happen in a school that you might come to 50% of your teachers not teaching to the curriculum? And obviously that has consequences with testing down the road. And so your test scores are going to be thrown all off and the kids aren't going to know what they're supposed to know. So I'm just sort of curious from an organizational standpoint, how that happens. How do you get to that point where, a large number of your teachers are winging it or using their own or making stuff up? And not to be critical of innovation there, but just if you have a curriculum, it's supposed to be followed. So how does that happen?
Mr. Klein, I really can't answer to like what happened prior to my being here. I've actually worked in where I worked in Massachusetts. We had a K-5 curriculum director who drove that bus of telling us what we needed to make sure was happening in classrooms, and curriculum was aligned across the district. But I also have only come from 7 school districts. This is a 22 school district. So I can't answer to that piece. I mean, there's no place I'd rather be than in a classroom, right? Like I, it's like my happy place. I always tell people, if you can't find me, come down to kindergarten because I'm down there hanging out, right? Having a grand old time, doing some math or some ELA with some kindergartners. But I do think it comes from potentially being bogged down by what happens within these 4 walls, right? It's a lot to manage a building. And it's a lot to manage, 60 plus staff members plus 430 students. And maybe getting bogged down by that and not prioritizing. I mean, there certainly are so many things in place that, like, I have a mentor that's wonderful that Mike has hooked me up with who's been helping me with situations. There's network directors now here in Manchester who are wonderful resources for me as a principal. I can bounce ideas off of them, you know, and they check in on us and make sure we're not getting stuck behind this desk, that we are getting into classrooms and ensuring that teachers are faithful to curriculum. It's a very supportive environment. I'm super lucky, feel super lucky to have, you know, come onto this team and feel that level of support. But I can't speak to what was prior to that.
Well, it's really good to hear that you feel supported and you have a good team there and you're experimenting and trying new approaches. I think that's very encouraging. Thank you for sharing. First, Helen has a question. And then I saw you, Anne.
I don't so much have a question, although I do now. and I wanted to say to both our, to all three of our presenters that this has been extremely useful, very helpful. I couldn't be happier to learn about the successes that you've had in your schools. So now that was going to be my comment that you've made my day, week, month. It's really just wonderful to hear from you on this. So then two comments. One, to Principal Wilson about fidelity to curriculum. So what happens when there is an educator who feels like, you know, I think our curriculum is, sticking to our curriculum is really important, but these kids are not getting the numeracy concepts in this way. And so I need to look at, I'm just making that up, obviously, as an issue. I need to look at some other tools. Is that within the realm of what they'd be supported to do?
Yeah, I can give you a concrete example because it actually happened this week. So okay. I have a math instructional coach and a general instructional coach in the building. And we realized that our third grade was a little off pace with their math instruction. So I offered to sit in on the meeting as a collaborator because I think that that's important. And what we did was we said, you know, why is this pacing off? And they shared with us that the kids didn't understand the concept of three-digit by three-digit addition, that they kind of missed that in the spring when we went remote. And now the expectation from second to third grade with that standard grows enormously. Mm-hmm. So what we did was we worked out a schedule and a plan of how we were going to review that systematically and what supports could we put in place for those teachers, but then allowing them to still move forward with the curriculum. So it has to be, but it has to be a culture of open dialogue, right? They could have hid behind their doors and been like, oh no, when is somebody going to notice that we're off pace? But they proactively came to us. And that's a culture that I'm trying to build in this building is that, yes, we need to be faithful to curriculum, but if the kids aren't ready to move forward, what can we do to support you and them moving forward?
Perfect. That's really what I was hoping the answer would be. So thanks very much. And then a question to both of you. I think there aren't enough hours in the day already. And I think you've talked about, needing to find the time to do the professional development and the, communities of practice and the kinds of things you need to do. Is there any place where CSI schools, are able to share their successes, sort of take it on the road and say, this is what's working, and not trying to lump all the schools together because they are different. And you can only really speak to your own building. But, for example, culture seems to be a common theme, at least between these two schools. And whatever you've done to support the culture that needs to exist for success. Is there a place where you can share the things that you're doing and that are working and maybe not working too, but what happens in order to do that? And I know time is clearly an issue. Whoever, Daz or John, you know, whoever wants to answer.
No, thanks for the question. So one thing I'll mention is that, and I'm not sure whether your question was about within the CSI schools or more broadly. So I can say within the CSI schools, we, like tomorrow, all the CSI schools are going to be coming together on a Zoom session. And we're going to be doing just that. We're going to be sharing. We're going to do breakout rooms where they, you know, the 12 schools break out into groups of three or four and, based on some common themes and then come back together and share all the work. So we definitely are doing that within the CSI schools. But your point, also makes me think, which we're not doing, which we certainly could do, is look at sharing that more broadly in the state. And we definitely could do that. We, as part of some other work we're doing with the commissioner and deputy commissioner, we are doing some statewide work around helping schools better understand how to use assessment data and some other best practices. And it would be a great venue for us to do a showcase of a couple of the CSI schools. So we'll add that to our list. That's a
great.
Yeah, Helen, I think that is so great. And I think it goes to the heart of something that also I think is really important that, and again, I think the state is very unique and different from some of the other states that I've worked in that CSI schools are not kind of these schools that are over there. They kind of failed and now look at them. CSI schools really in the state are put on this thing of, we have all of this funding. We should be doing all this innovation. We should be out there announcing to the world, look at what's going on. And so I love that idea. Any way that we could elevate, you know, our staff. I mean, my teachers are doing amazing things in the Nashua School District and things that other teachers may not be afforded the opportunity to do, but still they can learn from, wow, have you thought about this practice? And look, it's being done. It can do it. So I love that idea of putting us out there, because I really believe, like, it goes back to, we are the schools that are innovating. We are the schools that are building culture in very specific and effective manners.
Me too. I'm glad you want to do that.
Yeah, I just want to echo Helen's thoughts there. I mean, culture, and then we've heard this again for years. We've heard it over and over again from administrators and superintendents of how important culture is in a school and how that can really turn things around or send things in bad directions. And one of the things that charter schools do or are by law tasked with doing is sharing their innovative ideas. They're supposed to be the experimenters and they're supposed to innovate and they're supposed to bring back those innovations and share them with traditional public schools. And that doesn't always happen. We're working on promoting that. And I think as a department and as a state board, one of the things we would love to encourage and facilitate if possible is sharing your experiences with turning culture around. We can get these, and that's part of what should be going on, is this experimentation and innovation. And if you find things that work, getting that networked out and sharing it, those best practices can be really tremendous. And I hope we can encourage you to do that and maybe get the department to work with you through whatever means would be the best to just start to share some of these ideas, because I just think it's so important to create good cultures and share those and be enthusiastic. And I love your enthusiasm. So this was a very cheerful presentation from you guys. So thank you. I know there's a lot of work to do and a lot left to be done, but I think it was encouraging seeing how you're tackling it. Do we have any other comments or questions? I don't see any other hands up.
I think school member Lane wanted to.
Ann, did you?
Yes, I did. Thank you. Mike and Paul and Chaz, thank you all for spending some of your morning with us. And congratulations on your schools both having growth. What stands out for me, and I'd just like you to try and help me understand this. Paula, you mentioned high caseloads, lack of paraprofessionals, staff turnover, curriculum resources as all compending or exacerbating a circumstance where you're not meeting achievement or making achievement. You've both made growth. That's awesome. But if you could share with us what really is your roadblocks to achievement. Is it what Drew brought up, which was a failure to follow curriculum so that your kids can't matriculate from grade to grade because they don't come with the same backpack full of knowledge? What is it that's causing your achievement numbers and obviously then keeping you a CSI school?
Paula, do you want to go?
Go ahead, Jazz.
You're great. I'm all good with this one. Yeah, no, and that's a really good question. It's pretty amazing the complexity of schools. Over the course of my career, I've been a principal for probably 16, 17 years now. And what I've realized more and more as I get, my hair gets grayer, is that there's a real sense of what I thought was kind of a simple thing actually is rooted in some pretty complex stuff. So, to answer your question more specifically, what I've seen in my career and the way I'm working with Ledge is that focus matters. But that's not new to any administrator to say, listen, we have to focus on this part of the curriculum, or we have to focus on guided reading, or we have to focus on this part of the math curriculum, right? That's not new. But I think what's new with brain research and research on how we build cultures within an educational organization is that teachers need to know the why. They need the why behind that in order to make sure it becomes a fabric of what they do every day, and that I don't have to be right there standing with them. And then when I leave, they close the door and they do something else. There has to be a moral imperative with the staff that says, this is our focus and it's important because. And so for administrators, we really have to work diligently to create that why and communicate that why to staff. Because I think one of the biggest problems I think in Ledge that I've seen we've had to overcome, that I think we've made some good steps with, is really saying, focus on this. Because when we tell our brains, anybody's brain, you focus on this, then that's something the brain will concentrate on. And so that's really where that comes from. For me, it's that fidelity that every single day it means something that we post our objective, we actually tell the kids the objective, we tell them why we're learning that today, and then 10 minutes later we come back and we say, don't forget, this is why we're learning. That's what we're learning in our brain research with BERC and with Tier 1 instruction. All that stuff is so important. But again, there has to be that glue, that binding agent that says, when I walk out of the room, these teachers have a moral imperative that this is what gets taught. Because when that happens, then everything snowballs. Things get taught. They're able to put in interventions. They're able to know what kids are learning, when they're learning it, what to do when they're not, what to do when they are learning it. And then that's all of a sudden, all the data starts going forward. All the student learning starts to rise. I feel like I just vomited all that at you, Anne, and I'm not sure that made a ton of sense.
No, for all of us on the board, student achievement is ultimately what drives us to Concord or to our office. and so it's a concern to me. I know it's a concern to fellow board members that year after year, not seeing progress, seeing growth, but not seeing actual achievement, is a concern. And what can we do to help you get there? What is it that's missing? And I think you've just spelled that out. And I hope that philosophy is something that is bought into by your building. And Paula, you've only been there for a year, so I look forward to next year to see what your students can achieve.
Yeah, and I'm super excited. And it actually hasn't even been a year; it's been like 8 weeks.
Oh my word!
I started September. I got hired August 31st at the, what do you guys call it, the Board of School Committee.
I got goosebumps.
I'm trying to learn all these Massachusetts, New Hampshire lingo. I'm trying my best.
Wow.
So it's only been about 8 weeks. But to answer your question, because I know you had specifics about my key challenges, I know the district is moving toward helping us out with some of these challenges by the hiring of our network directors here in Manchester, adding that extra layer. I think that, you know, we're moving, the district as a whole is moving forward, not just Wilson. So I'm hopeful that with, you know, where this district is headed under new leadership in the last year or so with Dr. Goldhart, that we're headed there. And I think that the use of the evaluation tool for me is going to be imperative in making sure that we're only delivering the highest quality education to our students every single day.
Thank you. Mike, if I could ask you a question.
Of course.
So CSI schools receive funding above and beyond what non-CSI schools receive, and is that's based as a per pupil number?
Yeah, there's a minimum, you know, starting point, and then it's per pupil. They get additional funding.
Okay. So my continued question, if I may, And if it's not yourself, who is it that is more familiar with the high school level? And my question is there a correlation between more specifically for charter schools, is there a correlation between funding and achievement?
I can try and weigh in on that, Mike. I don't know if you know the answer. I don't think I know the answer to correlation between funding and achievement at our CSI high schools. Is that the question, Ann?
Primarily charter schools, high school charter schools.
Yeah, so I don't think I've ever done that correlation, so I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm in my heart, I believe there's probably a correlation.
All right. So I think Christine had her hand up, and then we have our public hearing starting in a few minutes.
Drew, can Andy?
Kate also is okay. Has her hand up.
I saw Christine first, so I'm just going to go ahead and let Christine do it, and then Kate, you're next.
Yeah, you know, you can let Kate go, and I'm just going to wrap it up. So that's fine.
Okay, great. All right, Kate, go ahead.
I really enjoyed the accountability report and the whole presentation. I love the enthusiasm. So in taking a look at your, I printed it out and all your goals. Christine, is there going to be a date, another report at the end of the school year so we can see if they've met all their goals? Are we going to have another presentation? It would be really interesting to do a wait on it.
I think that this is something that we're hoping to, that's going to be ongoing, and we can think of working with Mike on his team, coming up with some sort of summary or comparison.
Right.
And I think it's important to remember that we did take a year off with our statewide assessment.
Mm-hmm.
So the data is going to come a little bit later if we use one, that is one of the measurement tools.
It's a great talk, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I'll, it is a great presentation, and I just want to thank these two courageous leaders to come forward because I know that they're excited to share their work. And I also want to really thank them for reaching out to the families right now during these times, especially to get those foundational skills of reading. Chaz, it was great to hear that the distinction between leveled readers and library books. Because when kids are feeling success and sharing with their families and their teachers, they're more apt to continue to keep on reading and not quit early. And right now, there's such a huge concern, you know, to make sure kids are getting these foundational skills. And I was like, Paula, nice to hear that you're going out to the homes and getting books in kids' hands and doing that serve and return and having that love of literature. So thank you, and thanks for coming forward. And I can't wait to hear the rest of the CSI schools. Thanks, Mike, too, for getting this together.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks to all of you. That was very informative.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we actually have 3 minutes before our public hearing starts, and we do have some folks signed up for that. We had restraint and seclusions on before. We can go ahead and start that. If Diana is on.
Yep, let me just kind of move people around a little bit. Hold on.
Thank you very much, everyone. I've actually got to go talk with some kids. So thank you all very, very much. I appreciate all your time you took this morning. I'll look forward to seeing you all again soon.
All right, thanks.
Bye, thank you so much. Have a great day, everybody. Stay well.
Thank you, everybody.
Diana should be coming up shortly. I think she's with her and Rich are together.
Yep, and she's up. She's online. We're ready to roll.
All right.
Rich.
Hi.
All right. Diana and Rich, you have 2 minutes.
2 minutes. You got it. My name is Rich Farrell. I'm the investigator of the Department of Education. I'm going to talk to you about the restraint and seclusion report, and I think also the bullying report. We can get through that pretty quickly and leave it open for questions. The first thing I have to say is that the numbers, first of all, the numbers are a little off this year because, of course, from March 15th until 30 June, there was virtually no reporting. So you have to take a look at that in comparison to previous years. The second thing is that I'm very pleased to announce that both the public and the non-public schools reported had it done on time, and we've been able to accommodate and document every school, both public and non-public. This is the second year we've been able to do that. Very pleased about that. It was a lot of growing pains, and now we seem to have it down to a science. Restraint and seclusion for public schools. If you take a look at the numbers, this year, 1,786 total restraint reports. That's down from 2,860. And even if you factor in 15 March through 30 June, I think you'll see that there's a reduction in total restraints. In the total number of injuries were 4. And I contacted each one of those 4 schools. None of them were serious injuries. Each one of them were documented. Each one of them we investigated, and we were able to clear it for any educated misconduct. The initial number came in at 7, and after reviewing 3 of those reports, we determined that those were not injury. They were not injuries related to restraint or seclusion. So the number went from 7 to 4. The one public school that really stands out is Broad Street. Broad Street talked about 464 issues of restraint with a total of 142 seclusions. I talked to the people at Broad Street. What you need to know about Broad Street is in Nashua, a lot of children, autistic children and other children with some significant needs go to Broad Street. And Broad Street has a policy that any hands-on involving students is reported. So the 464 is not necessarily the actual number of restraints as defined by statute. If you really want to get a closer idea of which restraints are actual restraints as defined by the statute, I would go over and take a look at the 142 seclusions. So the restraints and seclusions kind of match up, and I would say that the 142 is a much more reasonable number for actual restraints as defined by the statute. The rest of the cases, I wanted to bring out one at elementary school. They indicate they had 14 total restraints, 14 seclusions, and this is pretty standard with schools. They were all the same child. So it sounds like a big number for that particular school, but the restraints and the seclusions involved a single individual child. The second group of restraints that we looked at were the non-publics, and again, the non-publics are down. But again, the numbers are a little off because of the amount of time kids weren't physically in school. The total number for 1920 was 1,827, which is significantly less than the 3,000 reported last year. And again, if you take a look at some of the numbers, you will find that there are places like Monarch School. Monarch School reports every hands-on, regardless of the definition of restraint. They report every single hands-on with respect to their students. Crotchet Mountain, they have a high number, and obviously the high number is based on the population. We were able to document and determine each one of the reported instances of injuries. The injuries ranged from a broken arm at Joliker School, and the broken arm is a result of not necessarily the restraint, but the child, the student, was self-injurious, and the broken arm he was brought to the local hospital, and they determined that his arm was broken, but he did it himself, and restraint was necessary to curb him in. The other injuries were minor. The most serious, of course, was the one injury that was a broken arm. Basically, that's the breakdown of the numbers. Before we go into bullying, do you have any questions for me?
Okay, Ann has a question. We are going to have to start the public hearing, though, here quickly. So, Ann, can you do a real quick question?
Rich, good morning. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Is the downturn in the reporting based on schools having more information on the definition of these categories, or is there something else? And do you have confidence in these numbers?
The numbers, in terms of what the numbers are, I have confidence in what they've reported. I think the numbers are high. We talked last year, and I'll say it again this year. I think the numbers are high in that they're not consistent with what the statute defines as restraint. Like in the case of Broad Street, any hands-on in Broad Street gets reported. That's a district, Nashua School District policy. It's a Broad Street policy. But the number is not consistent necessarily with the definition of restraint. So they report any hands-on whatsoever. So that number, yes, I believe in the case of, say, Broad Street, that number's real, but is the number consistent with what the statutory definition is? I don't think so. I think it's high.
Rich, can we just really quickly, for those schools that do that, I understand the desire to keep those records. Can the state say, look, you keep that for your records. If you want to keep every time a student's touched, you keep that. But we want to see reported only the statutory definition.
We've tried that. In some cases, schools have worked with us to streamline and identify what restraint is. Other schools are going to continue doing what they do. And I think that the problem that rises is how do you then do the bookkeeping to separate the actual restraints from the total hands-on.
I mean, I think if you're running a spreadsheet as a school administrator, you just have two lists. You have, okay, statutory definition, check that, hands-on, check that, and it's not that bad.
I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you at all, but we've had trainings, and the numbers are getting smaller, and we'll have to keep working with local districts on that.
Okay, Helen has a question.
So Broad Street has the preschool for students with disabilities, one of the preschools, and many of the students who go there come from, Broad Street isn't necessarily their home school, but I think one of the prime reasons for this, for the statute, is to really make sure that students with disabilities in particular are not restrained. And so I wanted restrained inappropriately. And so I want to be sure, Richard, that we're not in any way dismissing the numbers that are being provided from a school like Broad Street. And if you talk with them, that it's clear that there aren't any inappropriate restraints for students with disabilities happening.
We have had conversations with Broad Street, and in the past school year, we had one allegation of educator misconduct from Broad Street that we investigated along with the SEU 42, and we made a series of determinations there. We track any reports of educator misconduct related to restraint. Last year, of the over 200 cases that we drew for educator misconduct, about 25 came to us as reportable for misconduct associated with restraint. And of those 25, there were a couple of staff members in districts that were terminated, and one of which we took action against at the state level. So we do work with them. We look at the actual restraints and which ones are reported to us for misconduct.
All right, everybody, I really have to start the public hearing now. So we're a little over time. But if any other board members have questions, we can call you guys back.
Sounds great.
A good presentation. I'm sorry I have to cut this, but we really do need to start public hearing. So thank you so much. All right, Angela.
Okay.
We have some folks signed up. I am going to officially gavel the public hearing in
10:38.
So we have, as I have the list here, I have Bill Caruso up.
Correct. And I don't, Amanda's trying to reach out to him now. I do not see him there. I do see Bonnie. So
okay, why don't we do Bonnie first since she's here?
Okay, just take a moment.
All
Hi. Sorry. I was on, I thought we had to do it on the phone, so I had the phone and the thing on here. So.
Whatever your preference is fine.
Well, no, this is fine. Thank you very much. Bonnie Dunham from Merrimack, New Hampshire, and I'm speaking as a parent of a young man who benefited from special education. While I know that the New Hampshire Department of Education and school districts have been working very hard to try to meet the needs of children with disabilities, all children, in fact, during this pandemic, school districts throughout the state have had mixed results. It varies widely from district to district in meeting the needs of children with disabilities, particularly children with the most complex or intensive needs. That's a huge problem. I submitted written testimony in which I highlighted the areas where I'm requesting changes and included those changes in there to make it a little easier. So I'll just give a quick review, though. After ED 306.22, which says the local school board shall adopt policies relative to all distance education offered by the school district, I ask that you add language modeled after executive order number 64. The policy shall specify that when a school district is providing instruction through a distance education model or through a hybrid model that includes distance education, procedure shall be established to ensure the provision of a free appropriate public education for all children with disabilities, including through the provision of in-person instruction and related services, if necessitated by the student's individual needs and consistent with the health and safety needs of the child, the child's teachers, and the child's family. I know that you've heard from education organizations that increased flexibility is needed, but giving school districts the ability to choose from an array of instructional options, and then if distance education is offered, requiring school boards to adopt policies without establishing specific requirements for those policies is taking flexibility to the extreme. I think that flexibility is great, but in terms of providing a FAPE, there is no option. Failure is not okay. You have to ensure that every child, unequivocally, regardless of where that child lives, has a right to receive instruction, including the special ed and related services that he needs, in a way that allows that child to both access and benefit from that instruction. Right now, during this period where schools have been utilizing remote instruction, distance education in terms of these rules, that has not been happening for every child with a disability. Some New Hampshire children with disabilities have fallen through the cracks. Some have gotten few services. Some have gotten no services. Some have gotten services from which they received little, if any, benefit. And that can't continue. I'm asking for one other change after ED 306.22b, which says in the first sentence, school districts may offer students the multiple instructional options, including traditional classroom, distance education, or hybrid instruction models. I ask that you add, unless the use of distance education is necessitated by an emergency, including a public health emergency, traditional classroom education shall be one of the options offered by each school district. I haven't heard anyone in any school district say that after the pandemic is over, they plan to continue using distance education as their exclusive model for delivering instruction. But the language in these rules does not disallow it. And I'm really big for clarity. And so I think that it's important that language be made more clear so that in-person instruction needs to be available. I know how much my son and his peers, those peers with and without disabilities, benefited from learning from each other in inclusive classrooms. And I want to ensure that these rules make certain that that option continues to be available to children in every New Hampshire school district. Thank you.
Thanks, Bonnie. And you did send those proposed changes in to Angela, right?
Yes, you're actually going to be getting two because I sent a rough draft yesterday and then I sent a final one today. And so just ignore the first one.
Okay, so we got the final. I know we got that.
Thank you.
We'll share that with the board. We're not voting on this today. This is a public hearing, right, and we'll discuss it later. So we do have time to think about that.
I wanted to say one more thing. The State Advisory Committee hoped to submit some testimony, but the timing of this hearing and our meetings didn't allow for that. But you may be hearing from some individual members who say that they are serving on SAC, but they will be providing testimony as individual citizens in their own capacity.
Okay. Thanks. All right. Is Bill Caruso on?
He is not, Drew, but I'm looking again. I know that Amanda tried to reach out to him and there was no answer. But Lisa Bowden is, she's next after, so we can have
her. Yeah, let's go to her. I know she's here.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good morning. I have not been in front of the board for quite some time, and I'm on a grant deadline, so I'm this board public hearing came up quick for me, so I appreciate your patience with my somewhat scattered testimony this morning. I am, again, Lisa Bodwin. I'm the executive director of ABLE New Hampshire, and I also currently serve as the chair of the New Hampshire SAC, but I am not providing testimony in the capacity as the chair of the New Hampshire SAC. ABLE New Hampshire believes it's imperative that New Hampshire's education rules ensure that students with disabilities continue to receive the same rights, protections, and services as students without disabilities. Our board of directors and our many hundreds of constituents from across New Hampshire were very pleased that both the governor in his emergency orders and the Department of Ed recognized the unique needs of students with disabilities to ensure that during the move to remote learning that all students received a free appropriate public education. Indeed, it was a Herculean lift to quickly implement remote learning last spring. Unfortunately, members of the board, according to parent surveys that ABLE New Hampshire conducted, many students with disabilities were an afterthought in that move in multiple districts across New Hampshire. ABLE New Hampshire knows of several families for whom students with significant disabilities have received little or no related services since March if they are electing to remain in remote instruction, and for whom remote learning is ill-suited to obtaining a FAPE. The Granite State's unwavering commitment to local control yields inconsistent and varying levels of creativity and effort. And I do want to say that Commissioner Edelblut was fantastic in encouraging schools to use collaboration and creativity, and many schools did not strive to that high level of creativity. So they were not able to meet the needs of children with disabilities. As such, we need to always have clear and strong language in all New Hampshire education rules to ensure that all students, including students with significant disabilities, have their needs met. ABLE New Hampshire concurs with Bonnie Dudham's requests to rule changes, which are in my written testimony. I will not repeat them because you just heard them from Bonnie. I would like to punctuate, however, that policies without specific requirements are not actual policies. So it is important that we do provide flexibility, but we need to have some boundaries around that flexibility. And I just want to say one more time that there are families in New Hampshire for whom their student going back to school was too high risk, either for the student because of complex medical needs or because of an extended family member who may have been living in the home. And I know you've heard this, that there are students with significant disabilities who are saying no thank you to in-building instruction. Those students, of which there are dozens, if not hundreds, of students across New Hampshire, are not receiving any related services, and therefore they are not receiving a free appropriate publication, because for those school districts, if you're not in the building receiving related services, you're not getting them. And functionally, in many instances, OT, PT, and speech cannot be delivered via Google Classroom or other remote mechanisms for students with the most significant disabilities. And ABLE New Hampshire continues to be very, very concerned about low socioeconomic status families for whom, due to their parents' limited education or low income, that they are not able to reach organizations like ABLE to get to the support they need to work out getting their student a free appropriate public education via the IEP team process.
Lisa, thank you so much. I know all of us share a lot of these concerns about making sure that all students receive the education that they need to receive. So we appreciate it. So next, we have Carrie Duren, if Bill Caruso is not here.
Right, I still don't see him, but I'll go ahead. I do see Carrie, so let me just get her set up. There you go, she should be. All right.
Carrie, is it Duran or Duren?
Duran, like the band Duran Duran.
Fantastic.
All right. So good morning, everyone. My name is Carrie Duran, and I live in Wolfboro, New Hampshire. And I have a 9-year-old daughter, Katie, who has Down syndrome. And she is, I just tell you a little bit about what we're experiencing this year. So it's definitely been kind of, as a parent, a seat of the pants type of educational experience this fall as we're taking it day by day as to what's going to happen next and if we're going to be hybrid or online. So currently Katie is doing the hybrid model where she is at the Governor Wentworth Regional School District at Crescent Lake. She goes in person Monday, Tuesday, and because of her significant needs for, as it was interesting, as Lisa said, for speech, OT, and PT, we did not have a lot of success with those in the online version this spring. So the school was kind enough to set up that Katie goes into school Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday for 2 hours just to get those services. Because it was really difficult to get the quality services we needed online. And it wasn't because the teachers or staff were not working hard enough to make that happen. It just wasn't a good fit for Katie, and she just was not able to attend to those therapies while being online. So, so far, this experience, although challenging on a day-to-day level, she is having a little bit of a problem. Like when she gets home from her 2 hours, she, in her mind, she has already been to school, and there's still quite a bit of online learning that is supposed to happen Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday for her. So, you know, we're definitely trying to keep her on track, but she has fallen behind. So I've had to almost as a parent decide, are her therapies more important or her academics more important? And that's been really, really tough. So she, as I said, she is in school Monday and Tuesday. She is receiving a little bit of extra reading and math, but it's like 15 minutes per day. So unfortunately, even though Katie is just is super bright and super amazing and just a wonderful little girl, her academics level, she's definitely regressed a lot. I'm sure you've heard that from other parents. But for her health and well-being, she's also medically high risk. I've had to keep up with the PT and the OT for her and the speech, and really insist on those. And as I said, it's been difficult as a parent in worrying about the academics because I also work from home. So if I wasn't working from home and trying to work at the same time, I could definitely jump in and help more. And it's been, you know, I think there's many parents who feel that they are lacking as a parent, that they've let their children down because they can't give them the time that they need for their academics while they're working at home. I know I'm luckier than many people that I have that option, but especially we parents of children with disabilities who are used to being on it, on all the, on top of everything all the time. This has been a challenge. So I do worry for where she's going to be academically in the next few years. And I'm not really sure what the solution is, except for the pandemic must go away. But I just wanted to share my perspective and what's happening in our family up in Wolfboro. So did anyone have any questions or anything that I can answer for you?
I don't see anybody have a question. Well, thank you.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time.
Of course.
Angela, have we found the other speaker?
We did, and Amanda, he actually called in on her phone, so she's going to attempt a little phone-to-speaker.
Okay.
And see if we can actually hear him.
Okay.
So, Amanda, if you want to...
I've unmuted myself. I'm putting him on speaker. Bill, right. You're on speaker, and the state board will see if they can hear you.
Hello.
Yeah, we got you.
Yep, they can hear you, so.
Great. My name is William Caruso. My son is Nicholas Caruso. He goes to Shaker Regional School District. And so since we've started the remote learning, there's been, we've had some different things happen that is kind of, we thought was unusual as far as following the IEP. So as we understood, the IEP would be the same, and the only difference is the location of the child would change. So that would entail things as far as getting services that used to be maybe 40 minutes long were shrunken down to 15 minutes to 10 minutes. And this happened without an IEP meeting, without a consultation with the parents. It just kind of happened like that. And we requested as to how that could be or why. And as we went through the process, didn't really get a whole lot of exact answers other than this is what we determined, you know, the endurance would be for remote learning, which I'm not sure where that data came from or how they came to that conclusion. So on top of that, going through the remote learning, doing things like getting – our supplies and our notifications on changes to services and what we need to prepare at home for his learning, we would get that information sometimes at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night, and you have to be ready for Monday morning. So that kind of thing is still continuing. We had met with the superintendent about changing that communication style to maybe having it back to a Thursday. So at least we had time to prepare over the weekend for the start of the week. That did not happen. That hasn't changed. We still seem to get these notices on Sunday night. So with all these issues that are happening around remote learning, we also learned through this time period just how our son's education was being implemented during his service time and all the different struggles and problems. And so we figured out that when he was actually in school doing face-to-face learning, you know, his service for, let's say, DI was supposed to be 30 minutes of DI. With all the different transitions he was having and problems managing all those transitions and his behavior, he was actually only getting about maybe 7 minutes of DI. So at home, being in a safe place where he's in a familiar environment, he's not being challenged with all the different transitions that he would have during school, he's actually able to focus better and pay attention. And it seems like even with all the struggles we have with the school as far as communication and information and things like that, he seems to want to follow along more, and it almost seems like he's making a little bit more progress than he would normally than if he actually went to school and had to endure that environment. So for remote learning, it's hard for us as parents to give up the social interaction with other students, but what we gain is we know he's safe 100% of the time at home, and he is making what I think is more progress than he would normally make at school. But there is seems to be a lot of gaps with, you know, IEP and how that process works for remote as opposed to face-to-face learning.
Thank you for sharing that. I know I'm concerned about, we hear stories and we've been hearing them, and they come into the department about IEPs not being followed or being changed. You're required to get an annual IEP meeting, and changes are supposed to be done there. So I think, have you been in contact with the department about this?
We're working on that right now as far as doing a full complaint, I guess.
Okay.
And making that familiar to them.
Okay. We appreciate you coming forward. I think if parents have these problems where they don't feel like the rules or process was followed, that needs to come to the department. And if you feel like you're not getting the required instruction time, or support, that needs to come as well. So I encourage you to follow up on that, and thank you for bringing it to our attention.
Right.
Anybody have any questions? Okay. Thank you all the folks who testified. We really do appreciate it. Carrie Duran had a question. She just messaged. If you can put her back on, I'm happy to see if we can answer her question.
Yeah, let me see if I can.
She's still there.
Yep, I can see her. Let me just.
Hi, this is Carrie. One thing that I forgot to ask about is the New Hampshire Special Education Procedural Safeguards Handbook. Are there going to be updates made to that in regards to the distance learning? And I ask because also to Lisa Bodwin's point, a lot of families I know in my district who perhaps are not as plugged into the resources that I have really use this handbook quite a bit. So I was just wondering if there were plans, or maybe it's already been updated, but I just wanted to throw that out there.
Anyone who feels competent to answer that?
Can you just, I missed the beginning of that conversation. I apologize. Somebody came in my office and interrupted me. Which handbook is specifically were you talking about?
It's the New Hampshire Special Education Procedural Safeguards Handbook.
Yep, so I don't believe that is due for an update because, as you know, we just went through kind of the rule update, and then I believe it was updated in conjunction with the rule update. So to my knowledge, it's not. But if you have suggestions for how that handbook can be made more useful, if there are sections in it that you think we can add, we are always open to revisions, but there is not presently, to my knowledge, a planned update to that.
Okay. I think just having something in regards to distance learning would be helpful, even if it's an addendum that's only in there for a short period of time, you know, until the pandemic is no longer with us.
And so I might also suggest, Carrie, if you want to reach out to me, so we do actually have guidance out to, school leaders around their responsibilities, specifically for students to have individual education programs established during the pandemic instruction period. And then in addition, we issued a TA, which is broader guidelines around instructional expectations during the pandemic instruction. So one of those two resources might also be helpful for you as well if you've not become familiar with those. But if you reach out to me, I'm happy to get those to you.
Sure. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Do we have anybody else who came in to testify?
My mouse wasn't working. I don't think so. Amanda, I think this is it, correct?
That is it.
Okay.
Drew?
Yeah. Helen?
Hi. I did raise my hand. I'm wondering how long we are going to keep this open for testimony so that if there are folks who wanted to submit some written testimony, they would be able to do that. Was that noticed? I can tell you I did not read whether that date has been noticed.
There is a Amanda, Angela or Amanda, either one. There is a I forget off the top of my head how long. So the physical testimony is half an hour, and then there's a period after that. And I think it's 10 days, but I could be wrong about that. Do we know what's the window there for written testimony after a public hearing?
The statutory requirement for a board is that you don't have to leave it open. You can close it right after the hearing, but I posted that the written testimony can be received until November 19th, so 1 week.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Amanda. Anything else, Helen?
Nope.
Okay, your hand's still raised, by the way, on the little icon. So, all right. I'm going to leave this public hearing open for a few more minutes just because we started late, but we will move back to their strength and seclusion report. Obviously, Rich and Diana aren't on screen. Did anybody have any other points or follow-up on that? If not, then we'll need a vote to accept it. All right, seeing no hands raised and no comments, I'll need a motion from someone to accept the restraint and seclusion report. Okay, Anne has got her hand up.
So moved.
Okay, we'll need a roll call.
Was there a second?
Yep, me. I second it.
Kate Cassidy.
This is Sally. I do have a question, though, on that report. When Steve had mentioned the Broad Street School and why the numbers were so high, I mean, is there a way to put a notation on there, or it's just just acknowledging what the why that figure was so high.
Yeah, I kind of like that idea, and I think maybe having, because I always ask. I mean, I was emailing Diana.
That was my elementary school.
Just to explain some of the high numbers, and I know every year that comes up, we have that, and every year it's the same answer. Mm-hmm. That particular school has, a high population of special needs kids, or whatever the appropriate enrollment is. So I think I'll pass that along to Rich and Diana. And ask if there may be a way to notate or asterisk some of the schools. Like if we could separate out in the report, they're alphabetical, but maybe if we could pull or flag the schools that have a very high population or are designed for populations of kids who have special needs, that might be helpful. And then also flagging the schools that report all of their hands-on as opposed to the statutory definition would be helpful as well. And then that would allow Rich to flag that, but also be able to explain, because it's not obviously, even if you have a high percentage of kids who are problems for teachers, that doesn't necessarily follow that every one of those is justified. So it'll give us a chance to note the statistics, but also have an explanation and talk about investigations and so forth. So that's something I think we'll pursue. Yeah, Helen?
I would be concerned about that. I understand that there may be a difference in terms of reporting, but if that school feels as if they need to report and want to be consistent, I think it's certainly Richard's obligation to check into it. You know, you see 450, that is a huge number. But I wouldn't want us to in any way be dismissive that, you know, those numbers are okay, either because there's a high population of special needs students that we really need to be concerned about that. If a school wasn't as diligent perhaps as the Broad Street School is, in reporting, I wouldn't want to dismiss it. So that's just my concern. I'm glad that there was further information provided. That makes me feel better. But I would be concerned about differentiating about populations in a school.
Oh, well, I wasn't suggesting to dismiss it. I was just suggesting the caveat is what, you know, that's what that was explained to us.
I understand. I know you weren't trying to suggest to dismiss it.
Anybody else? All right, so Anne has made a motion, I believe. We'll need a second and a roll call. Did we have a second?
I think Kate seconded, correct? So roll call, Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Helen Honoreau?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Dang.
All right. Also, just so you're aware, I did receive a message that Moira Ryan would like to testify before you close the public hearing.
The public hearing is past our 30 minutes. I started it at 10:37, and we're 3 minutes past. And she did submit written testimony.
Okay.
All right. So, yeah. So sorry. It's just. Just missed the window here, but we are closed. And we have her written email, which I'll make sure. Angela, if you have that or someone forwarded it to me, we'll make sure the whole board has it.
I think what I have forwarded all the everything that's been submitted to date, but I will compile it all in a single document and send it out so everybody has it in one document.
Okay. Excellent.
Angela?
Yes.
You didn't ask me, and I voted yes. You went through everybody
else. I'm sorry, Kate. Kate Massey, the roll call. Whoa.
It's easy while you forget your notes.
Sorry.
Okay. Thanks to everybody who stuck through that. I know these aren't necessarily easy technologically, but we appreciate your understanding. That actually went pretty smoothly. All right, so before we get to CTE, would anybody like a break? This is when we normally take a break. Okay, I see head nodding. All right, so Angela, what we'll do is keep everything's open. We're just going to keep the tape rolling. If you want to, you know, for decorum's sake, turn off your individual camera or whatever, we're going to take 5 and be back here at 11:17 by my clock.
Perfect. Okay.
All right. Thanks. Okay. Up next, we have Keene State.
Let me just go and grab Tanya. It's Tanya, correct?
Yes. Yeah, it should be Tanya Sturtz from Keene State College.
She is in twice, so I'm just...
She may have one of the faculty members present. I'll let her introduce Josh if he's there. But in short, Keene State, as part of their review of some of their science programs, have analyzed and made adjustments in their science for middle school level candidates This is does not require any action. However, this is more information regarding some of the changes that are occurring within their program involving coursework and a name change. And we felt it was important to share this, especially as it involves STEM and STEM education and preparing future educators in a more broad-based manner. So, Tanya?
Hello, can you hear me? I'm Tanya Sturtz, and Jacob Pleasance, I think, is all the other Tanya Sturtz on the line. He's in charge of our secondary science. The change that's made is that Keene State, we have no changes are being made to our secondary science, the education courses. The change is being made to what was our content area, general science, for our middle school group. And now it's going to be changed to STEM for middle school educators. Jacob can speak more to it if you have questions. But basically what it does is it realigned the courses that we had with the next generation science standards and also added some courses in STEM education and some engineering and science courses, I mean math courses as well.
Yep, and I'm here. I'm Jacob here. I'm happy to share more about what changes were made and clarify any of the details.
I believe Helen has a question.
Thank you. So this board has been focused pretty uniformly on making sure that the content areas are really strongly emphasized in the teacher preparation programs. In my reading of what was happening here in the changes, it looked like there was an attempt to strengthen content, but also broaden it a bit. Am I reading that correctly?
I think so. And in particular, our intent was to more closely align the content that was in there with the updated next generation science standards. And that includes some attention, which needs to be in there on engineering, which is now part of the science standards. So that was a very deliberate choice. So the program itself, the major, is still as rigorous as before. We still have an emphasis on content. It's very much a realignment and a refocusing to make sure that what we are doing is going to prepare our people best for what they're going to be teaching in the classroom.
Okay. Sounds like a great idea. Thanks.
Anyone else have questions? All right, seeing none. Thank you guys for coming and presenting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Okay, we are down to charter school updates and reports. Is Jane on the line?
Hello, this is Jane.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, good morning, everyone. This morning, I'm here with Jesse Badger from Northeast Woodland Charter School. The school has requested a modification to their charter, which will increase their enrollment by 35 students. Jesse Badger, as I mentioned, is on the call, and he can answer any questions that you have. And I'll turn this over to Jesse.
Good morning, members of the board.
Good morning. Thanks for coming.
Excuse me. So we're requesting that we adopt our year two numbers ahead of schedule. This year we have seen demand that has outpaced our projections, and given that we have secured more space than we originally anticipated, we would like to be able to offer the remaining spots, which we currently have waitlisted. And then this will also clear up a misunderstanding that we had on our part that out-of-state students wouldn't count against the New Hampshire-funded enrollment levels. And so we wanted to get our numbers more in line with the number of students we have right now. Currently, we have 3 students over our allocated 145. All of the students that we accepted, out-of-state students, were accepted after the open enrollment period ended, and all New Hampshire applicants were accepted into the school. Subsequently, after opening, we've had quite a bit more demand than we anticipated. So now we have a wait list, and we have room for a few of those students and anticipate possibly even more space opening up.
Excellent. Anyone have any questions? No questions? All right. Thank you for this report. I think it's encouraging that we have that you guys just opened and are already blowing past your enrollment numbers. So congrats. Do we have a motion?
Yes, pursuant to RSA 194-B:3,11, I move that the State Board of Education authorizes Northeast Woodland Charter School to amend the charter to increase enrollment for the 2020-2021 school year to 180 students.
I second it.
There was a second from Kate.
A roll call. Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Helen Honoreau?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Abstain.
Thank you so much for your time. And I also just wanted to let you know that next Monday at 3:30 in the afternoon, we're going to have a ribbon cutting ceremony along with members of the public. So we would love to have any members of the board who would like to join us and tour the school and see the fantastic location that we have there and all those resources that we're making available to the community. We would love to have anybody who would like to attend.
I'm sorry, what was the date?
It's going to be next Monday at 3:30.
Great.
And we'll get formal invitations out to everybody with the exact address and all of that through Jane.
Well, good. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Next item on the agenda, we're going to just hold until next month. That was not supposed to actually be on the agenda for this month's meeting. So we'll go down to legislative updates. Amanda, are you on?
I am on. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so we're starting with the final proposal for ED 306.27D, demonstrated knowledge and skills. So this rule has been amended slightly from its initial proposal version based on some of the public testimony that we received, specifically from Nicole Highmark. We changed placement pretest based on her testimony to assessment, and then changed the last sentence to shall be eligible to take another course. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that OLS has not submitted comment on the initial proposal, which usually happens before this stage, but they're really behind in because of the change in procedures for COVID. So when we submit the final proposal, we will receive comment from OLS before it goes to JELCAR.
Okay. Any discussion? Anne has a hand up.
Unmute. Good morning, Amanda. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. Thank you.
In 306.27D, in the paragraph that was provided toward the end, where it states competencies contained within the course, how are these competencies determined?
I'm going to let Frank answer the question.
Thank you. So we have a set of state competencies that we use. And essentially the competencies that we are using are the ones that are the competencies that were adopted by VLACs. So the same competencies that they've embedded in all of their coursework are the ones that we're using as our basis.
Should that somehow be referenced here? Because it seems really open-ended to me.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think we, achievement of competencies contained within the course, sure, the competencies I think is defined in the 306 rules. I have to go check that. So we define what those are. Okay. But if we need to, we can absolutely indicate what those are.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Helen?
Yeah. I remain concerned, and I raised this when this first came up, that we're essentially equating, as far as I can see, a placement or a pre-placement class to competency. And if we are a competency-based state, suggesting that someone should get a course credit, or, and the way the rules read, as far as I can see, is the district will have to accept credit in a particular course. It's mandatory, as far as I can see, for taking a test that if they don't have their own, the state is going to design, the department is going to come up with these competency assessments, and the district will have to accept credit for that course. And I don't equate those, and I don't think the testimony that we got indicated that those are the same. So there's a couple of issues there. The district having to accept credit for a course on a test that perhaps the department is going to design. And the second piece is that competency seems to be mixed up with a student being put into the right course for that level. And I think what we heard last time when these were first presented is because the reason for these is because the person who wrote the or was behind the competency-based position that the state is using felt that, you know, there sort of wasn't fidelity to that. And I don't think that's a good reason. The regulations and the statutes, whatever they become, they become. And if things that people felt in the underlying, as an underlying proponent thought should be there and weren't, I don't think you can reinvent that. And I am again concerned about requiring a district to take to give credit for a course that either they didn't design or they didn't that they didn't design. This again seems to me that we are conflating the meaning of a placement test with course credit and something that a student should get credit for. A student should be absolutely placed in the right level course, but giving them credit for the course is something different, and I remain concerned about that.
So if I may respond, Drew.
Yeah.
So thank you, Helen, for those comments, and I appreciate those. And I know that that's some of the feedback that you had provided to us previously. I will point out that this is Section D in 306.27, which talks about the placement pretest in the current language, not the newly adopted language. But if you just go down to F, in fact, I think you'll find that this direction is perfectly consistent with the idea of awarding credits. In Section F of 306.27, it states that credits shall be based on demonstration of competencies, not on time spent achieving those competencies. So, in fact, our districts are already under a shall be based on, they shall award credits, credits shall be based on the demonstration of those competencies. So a student who would have demonstrated competencies through the assessment in D would be entitled to those credits under F anyway. So there's not an inconsistency associated with that. I think the other thing that's really important to consider here is that we did reach out and work with some of the districts to try and understand where they were with respect to creating and affording our students the opportunity for these assessments, because it does say if a student demonstrates knowledge and skills on a placement pretest developed by the local school district for a particular course. In fact, what we've discovered is that there are no districts that are affording students those types of opportunities to be able to take an assessment and demonstrate their capacity over those competencies to then be allowed to be awarded credits under Section F. So really what this does is it says we don't want to have an inequity where perhaps a district might do one and another district would not. So the department is really helping, again, the districts to accomplish what the very rules are stating. And it's quite possible that if the department adopts an assessment, then the district can adopt an assessment. They can adopt that same assessment or they can adopt their own assessment. So it's really an enabling type of a rule change that allows and our students to be able to gain access to something that has been in our rules for many years. And I think that that's important for us to consider.
Helen.
So, Commissioner, if I could ask you to address a very specific example. The way middle schools and high schools in Nashua deal with pre-algebra and algebra is students who score or achieve in a certain way in the middle school are taking their final math class in their eighth grade year with that has components of what would be pre-algebra in high school. And so if they achieve in a certain way, then they don't have to take pre-algebra, but they can go, or algebra one, they can go into algebra two. And for that student who has achieved and is taking algebra two, and I have to recognize that my children graduated a while ago, but that's what it was when they attended. I think it's still similar. Do we want and we've heard from so many speakers, that there's concern about the number of math credits that students take in high school. Do we really want that student to get credit, not only be placed into algebra two, but also get credit for algebra one? I mean, what would be the rationale for that? That was the math credit that was deemed appropriate for them as their eighth grade year. Why should they get additional credit for that and have to take one less math credit when we've heard how important those are? What's the rationale behind that? Clearly it's an important placement tool, but why would we want that student to get credit for algebra one, for example, when they got credit in eighth grade and we're trying to promote math in high school? And just can we use that as an example of how these rules help there?
Jira, I would love to, and I think that that's a great example. So just to clarify, the placement pretest that you refer to that a student might take in middle school is actually a placement pretest that determines should they be able to enter into Algebra 1 or should they be able to take a pre-algebra test even or a pre-algebra class entering into that high school environment. We don't currently have any examples where a student would bypass Algebra 1 and go straight to Algebra 2. But essentially what we're trying to accomplish here is we've not reduced the math credits that a student would take. If a student, for example, takes the AP Algebra test and scores a 3 or higher on AP Algebra for Algebra 1, what this would allow them to do, if the AP test was an allowable assessment, we would say that student can now take they've taken an AP test, they've scored a 3 or higher, they can bypass Algebra 1 rather than spending all that year learning Algebra 1 when they've now demonstrated competency in it, and they would then normally go on to geometry before they would go to Algebra 2. So you'd award them the Algebra 1 credit, and so here's a student who now has an accelerated math, you know, trajectory because they've got 4 years in high school. So if they've now been able to demonstrate they already have the competencies in Algebra 1, they can take geometry, Algebra 2. They might then take a pre-calculus and a calculus class or a differential equations or a statistics class. So you open up more opportunities to that student to be able to acquire their math credits. And what this also does is it helps us solve I don't know if inequity is the right word, but we have circumstances in New Hampshire where students are taking algebra in eighth grade, and then when they transfer to the high school says you have to take algebra again because that's what we offer to our ninth grade students. And so I can tell you of a very personal example of a student who passed algebra in eighth grade because the middle school offered an Algebra 1 credit to eighth graders. When they got to ninth grade, that student had to sit through another year of Algebra 1 because that was the curricular path that they afforded that student. And even though the student in eighth grade had demonstrated mastery of the competencies for Algebra 1, they were required to take it again, as rather than allow that student who's already demonstrated mastery to continue on their educational trajectory because of a rigidity to the pathways that we allow folks to be able to have. And I think the only other thing that I want to kind of clarify is the fidelity that we referred to in the previous testimony was not about the intention here so much as the fact that we are not living up to our expectation for our families to offer them these opportunities for individualized and personalized pathways. If a student can demonstrate that they've mastered the competencies, we absolutely want to allow them to continue on their education or trajectory and not hold themselves back. I can tell you my own personal experience with one of my own children in this case, who transferred from one university to another. When that student got to Berkeley, they spent 2 years at one university and transferred to another. That college allowed them to clip out of 18 college credits at Berkeley. And so the colleges allowed them to do that. If we look at the Modern States program that we've just put in place and we allow students to get free access to CLEP examinations, there are 2,900 colleges across the country that will accept those CLEP examinations for college credit. So if a student in New Hampshire can get college credit for passing the CLEP Algebra 1 test, why wouldn't we want them to have high school credit if that college is going to give them credit as well?
Go ahead, Alan.
Thank you. I think you're mixing apples and oranges, Commissioner, with respect. I think the CLEP exams are a wonderful thing, and I encourage students to take them, and I encourage students to understand that not all colleges will take them. That has unfortunately been a problem. And hopefully that there will be better communication with students to understand whether those CLEP credits can be helpful. But, you know, going back to the math, I don't understand why a student who has taken the curriculum in eighth grade doesn't, you know, within a school system, if you're going to the high school within your district, isn't allowed to take geometry in the example that you gave, and isn't that a problem with that high school not communicating with the middle school if that student is qualified to take geometry? That student should in fact take geometry. That's what those pretests and placement exams are designed to do. They aren't designed to give credit for that class. Those are two separate things, getting credit for that class. And so that student, most high schools require a certain number of lower level classes before you can take the AP exam. And geometry would be one of them for taking the AP calculus exam. And so those prerequisites seem to me to be the important part versus you need to get credit for it. Because I'm still hearing that a student who took classes in the middle school are getting credit in high school for that when they really should be in geometry or, you know, whether the sequence is algebra two. I think you're right, Commissioner. It's geometry, algebra two. It's all coming back to me now. But those, I think, are different things. Getting kids not requiring them to do the same thing again, but getting them placed in the right classes. And the credit seems to me not to be what those kinds of assessments are designed to do.
Helen, if I can just jump in real quick. I actually have what I don't understand is the way you're thinking about it. And I just guess here's how I think about it. And maybe you can answer this question for me. So our existing rules in 306.27, and I'm reading from this, students shall be provided courses in a classroom setting that will enable them to demonstrate achievement of graduation competencies. I think we should pay very careful attention to that sentence. The courses in the classroom setting exist for one and only one reason: to allow the student to demonstrate a competency. That's why we have courses. It is not the other way around. That has been in rule for a very long time. We're a competency-based system. Our rules say we set the competency expectations. The courses are designed so kids can demonstrate whether they have met the competencies. If a kid can take a test and demonstrate that the kid is competent in computer science, algebra, a foreign language, you name it, any of these, physical education, arts education, right? We have English. You can take a class. If you can demonstrate that you have achieved those graduation competencies, why in the world would you not get credit for having demonstrated those competencies? The class exists for the sole purpose of the child being able to prove that he is competent or she is competent. That's the one and only reason the class exists. If you can take a test and prove that you're competent, what possible justification is there for making you sit through that class or for not granting you credit for it? So, for example, and I'll use foreign language as an example. So we just had a school where close to half of their kids are English as a second language. Those kids are going to get to high school. They're going to be fluent in Spanish or whatever the language is. If you can take a placement pretest and test out of Spanish 2 and prove that you've demonstrated the competencies, you can fluently speak Spanish. under the current system, you still have to take 2 years of foreign language. Not Spanish, maybe, but you have to take, you might choose Spanish and ace it. But the current system does not allow them to get credit for that. You can place out of it, but you don't get credit. Why would we make a kid who's fluent in Spanish sit through 2 years of foreign language when they are competent in Spanish? So that all this rule change does is say, if you can demonstrate competency on a placement test, you get credit for the competency. I just think that's so obviously, manifestly common sense that and that's what I think I'm just missing, that we're miscommunicating or something, or what I don't understand is, why wouldn't a child get credit if they can demonstrate that they're competent to receive the credit?
Drew, I might just also add, and again, going down to Section F, that the credits are already required. Like, schools are required to give credits based on demonstration of the competencies, not on time spent achieving those competencies. That is the current rule that we have in place.
Drew?
Yeah.
I support everything you've just said, and I support for one reason, that I believe our primary focus should be on positioning students for success. And if that's our goal, then how far along the trajectory of any subject they can get, we've done our job. And I believe the way the system works is you have to, in order to get credit for something, you have to take the course. Or I'm perhaps not saying this correctly. I think Helen's point is you can't jump from algebra to geometry until you've taken algebra. Well, the point is the student has mastered the subject matter by they've in fact, they've taken the course at some point and mastered the competencies. And so inherent in that is being deserved of credit. So I thank you. You stated that quite eloquently, and I wish I could say it as well.
I mean, I think the point that Helen, not to put, just to clarify, I think your point, Helen, was that you accept that they move to the next level. The placement is okay, that they don't have to sit in the classroom and take Algebra 1 if they place out of it, but that they shouldn't. So Helen's not arguing that you should have to sit through the class again. I just want to be fair to Helen on that because there was misunderstanding.
Don't.
And yeah, and so I got that, Helen. I know that's not what you're saying. But that if you give them credit for that class, it messes up the credit system, right? So if you have 4 math credits you have to take, if you place out of Algebra 1, you're placed into geometry. So you start your 4 credit path with geometry.
2 credits.
Two credits. Okay, 2, 4, whatever. You know, I'm just throwing out. I think my point is, if you've placed out of a math course because you demonstrated competencies, you should get credit for those competencies. And then it's up to you going forward to choose to either take. So let's say you, just an example of algebra, you place out of Algebra 1. So you take Algebra 2 and geometry, and geometry and Algebra 2, right? Then if you don't get credit for the Algebra 1, then you have to take another math class to get that extra math credit. If there are, like, there are 4 math credits, so you have to take math, right?
It's 2 or 3, but you don't have to take all 4 years math. I'm sure the commissioner knows the answer to whether it's 2 or 3 math credits you have to take.
I'm just using 4 as an example of, because a lot of kids take math every 4 years. Okay, regardless, I mean, I've got it in the statute here. I just don't feel like looking it up. So whatever it is, let's say it's 2. So you take geometry and algebra 2, you've met your 2 math credits. Or you could take geometry. And that's all you have to take under the system we're proposing because you've placed out of Algebra 1. Now, I don't think it's 2 credits. I think it's more than that. But I guess my point is
Thank you, Commissioner. 3 credits.
Yeah, it enables the student to then continue to pursue advanced math if the kid is in fact very advanced in math, right? Or to use that time to get other credits, to accumulate other credits. I guess I'm getting on a little bit of a tangent here. My point was already made. I just don't see the harm in allowing them the credit for what they've placed out of by demonstrating the competency.
Can I follow up on that? There's, if you took the Algebra 1 course in middle school, you got credit for it. You had to take that class in middle school. You couldn't not take math every year in middle school. You got credit for it. And so to then again get credit in high school, I don't see why we would want to support that, and especially in the arena of math, 3 credits. I do remember now that we did up the credits to math in math to 3, but it's not that that child who took Algebra 1 in middle school. Why are you getting double credit for it? You got credit for it. You graduated from middle school. Why would you get credit again in high school? I don't understand that. That child should not have to sit through that class again. I do not suggest that at all. But they already got credit for it.
Helen, they didn't get high school graduation credit for it. And I think what every child is up against is the limited resource of time. A student might be a math whiz, and yet math whiz or math, pursuing a career in math is the last thing they're interested in, but it opens up their horizon to take on other subject matter once they've satisfied those requirements. We're making a huge leap to assume simply because a student is really strong in something that that's what they want to do with their life. Mm. The point is the kid mastered the material in middle school. Middle school doesn't require credits to graduate. Middle school, just if you pass the courses, they move you on. High school does. High school says you must have mastery in this subject matter, 3 in science, or 2 in science, 3 in math, 2 in French or Spanish or Chinese, and so forth.
Language.
Latin, which unfortunately we don't offer anymore. Well, not many schools do. My daughter's school did, but she had to leave the public system. I think we're losing sight of the fact that time is a limited resource. And if a child has mastered material and that's part of a requirement for graduation, they should get credit for it. And we should let them move on and define themselves rather than us defining them by artificial barriers to progress.
Well said, Anne. Thank you. Do you think we can move on to a motion?
Yeah, I think we're pretty talked out on this one. Anybody else? All right. Sally, you want to make a motion? You're muted. Sally, you're muted.
I'll make a motion.
Okay.
I'm just trying to find it on my phone, and it's so small. I've done this backwards. I should have had my Zoom on my phone and then the material on my computer. I'm sorry.
You want to make the motion, Sally? Okay, I'll make the motion. I move that the State Board of Education approve the amendment to ED 306.27 (D) (comma) demonstrated knowledge and skills.
I'll second it.
Sally, okay.
Roll call.
Hey, Cassidy?
Yes.
Anne Lane?
Yes.
Helen Otero?
No.
Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Abstain.
Is that?
3-1. Yep. All right. Okay, we have the final proposal for home education up next.
Hi, it's Amanda again.
Hello.
So a vote is needed today by the board to approve the final proposal for 8315 home education. At the public hearing, we received oral testimony from one person, one member of HEAC. However, we confirmed with that individual at that time that he wouldn't be submitting written testimony. So the final proposal was prepared, and there are no amendments from the initial proposal to the final proposal.
All right. Any discussion? Motion.
I move the state, you hear me through?
Yeah.
I move the State Board of Education approve the final proposal for ED 315 home education.
Ann Lane, second?
I'll second it. Oh.
Oh, Sally did. Sally, I heard your voice, so I'll give it to you maybe. We all set for roll call?
Yeah, roll call.
Okay. Kate Cassidy?
Yep.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Helen Honoreau?
Yes.
Sally Griffin? I can see your mouth. I'm reading.
Yes.
Okay. Drew Klein.
Abstain.
Thank you.
Okay. Amanda, item C.
Item C is Voc Rehab Programs, ED 1000. So I want to let you know that I did draft an objection response. Because we did receive a preliminary, or I asked for a preliminary objection because there were so many comments and it would take time to sort through the comments. I drafted an objection response, and the Voc Rehab team also found some things in the rules that they wanted to change. And they weren't insignificant things. We just kind of overlooked them. But when you're under an objection response, you can only change things in response to an objection. So I had submitted the objection response as a preliminary read to the attorney who was reviewing those rules for JELCAR, and she came back with some pretty substantive comments about some of the other things that we wanted to change. And so we consulted, the department consulted, we consulted with Drew, and we're asking to withdraw the current proposal. The rules are in effect under an emergency rule until January 11th. Therefore, we would need to enter into another emergency rule period until we can get a new regular rulemaking completed. What that emergency rule will look like is a little different than what I explained in the executive summary because we changed direction just a little bit. We had decided at first that we were going to create an emergency rule that just addressed the issues with the federal regulations pointing to the wrong federal regulation. We were going to change some definitions and just do some minor tweaks for this emergency rule. However, we don't think that will pass as it won't pass the requirement in the statute that requires the emergency rule to be different than the original emergency rule. You can pass a new emergency rule, but it has to be different than the original one. And if we're just making editorial changes, it wouldn't be that different. So what we have is our objection response, which has been thoroughly vetted by the OLS attorneys. So we know where the issues are. So we're going to create a new emergency rule that incorporates that proposal as our emergency rule. It's almost there. It's just not quite there. So this will allow us time to transition into regular rulemaking. Chris Bond and Lisa Hatz are on the line as well,
if you have any questions about our decision and the process, it's actually your decision, but this is our recommendation. And I do want to point out that this happens very frequently in the rulemaking process. I did confirm with the attorneys for GELCAR that this happens a lot. Agencies get to this final stage and they just can't get there, so they withdraw and start over. So it's not unheard of. It's not going to cause any waves with GELCAR. So if anyone has any questions, we can answer questions for you.
Any questions? No?
Can I make a motion?
Yeah.
I move the State Board of Education withdraw the final proposal for ED 1000 Vocational Rehabilitation Program.
Second.
Roll call. We good? Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Helen Otero?
Yes.
Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Abstain.
Thank you.
Okay, so next thing on our agenda is discussing remote instruction. And I just put that down. We're not voting on remote instruction this week. Today, we're going to take it up next month. But I just wanted to give us the opportunity to have a conversation if anybody wanted to talk about it. Anybody want to chime in or Helen?
Hi, Drew. I think we've gotten some written testimony from people today, and Angela, if that's part of what we're going to get in a single document, I think that would be really helpful before next month's discussion, or being able to have it would be really great. I would appreciate that. And I guess my other question is: Is the time frame still open for people to be able to provide testimony, written testimony for it?
I believe that was 6 days or something.
7 days.
Seven days. Yeah,
the 19th.
So it's still open if people want to send us stuff.
Okay. It obviously has raised a number of comments for people, particularly for those in the disabilities community, and I want to make sure that everyone is able to give us the feedback we're hoping to get. That's all. Thank you.
Yeah. Anne, did you have anything?
No.
Okay.
Can I just weigh in for a moment, Drew?
Go ahead.
So I appreciated the feedback that we got, and I thought it was great feedback. And I have been advocating throughout this pandemic about the importance of making sure we address and take care of the needs of our students with IEPs, and we'll continue to fight for them. And I know that some of the comments, again, some of that came in this morning, so I really didn't have time to assimilate it. And I think it's appropriate that we go through that process. The only thing that I just want to make sure that the board thinks through as we look at these rules is, because I know that some of the testimony included wanting to put a lot of different protections for special education students into this section of the rule. And I just want to be really careful because those protections exist throughout the body. Like nobody, this rule is really a permissive rule to allow the schools a tool to help educate their students, but it doesn't take away anybody's obligation to provide FAPE to students. And I just want to be really careful that we don't, by sticking it in here in this particular place in the rule, then maybe somebody can impute that if it's not in, specifically addressed in another place in the rule, that it doesn't apply. No, that is not changing. So we just want to be really careful how we do this, that we don't inadvertently weaken our ability to make sure that all of our students are afforded a FAPE opportunity.
Yeah, I think legally, it's a law, and the law is required regardless of whether we write that part of the law into that particular part of rule. And I want to take those comments and look at them and consider them. I just think we got to be careful what we write in a rule to not imply in other places that we didn't write it in. That it can be confusing. And if we know we have a blanket coverage under the law, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to spell it out again in the rule. But I definitely want to take a look at what they wrote and see if we can, what we're going to do with that. Helen?
No, I'm good.
Oh, your hand icon's still up. Anne?
I'd like to follow up on Helen's request. As I review this particular draft, V.A or comma A, Angela, would it be possible, as I think Helen asked, to get everything that's related to this rule as a separate package? I don't want to miss anything, and I'm looking at this, and I think I know what the original one said, because I think it's what isn't drawn out, but I'd really appreciate the original, then this draft, and then any input we've received, all to be collected into one document, which would make it easier for me to review it. Is that possible?
Yes, and I'll work with Amanda on that, because I think it's open for after it's closed, and then anything that comes in after this, I'll put it all together and send it as a.
I think that's what Helen was asking for, and I'm
yeah, happy
I'm
to
older than she is, so I struggle more.
I think I emailed you all this morning too, and just noted that that's what I would do. So,
thank you.
All on the same page on this.
All right. Anybody else? All right. So we'll get all the written comments. I'll make sure that gets to everybody. And then you can, you know, take that and mull over it and consider it for our next meeting.
Drew, this is Amanda.
Hey.
Hi, sorry. We do have a final proposal filing deadline of December 23rd right now.
Yeah.
So if there are recommended edits, we should get them so that we can draft a new final proposal for you to vote on at the December meeting so we can meet that deadline.
Gotcha. All right. Anybody else? Okay. We are down to commissioner's update.
Great. Thank you. A couple of things that I just wanted to bring you up to speed on is, our Canvas implementation, which is the statewide learning management system. Continues to go forward. And I think we had since our last meeting, we made some great progress. We were able to negotiate finally. It was difficult administratively just to work with them, but we've negotiated a statewide Zoom license. So now all of our school systems that are participating in the Canvas implementation have also gotten a free Canvas license, free, not really, free to them for 3 years anyways, a Zoom license. And what we're seeing as we kind of evolve and the response to the pandemic continues and we're trying to figure out ways to best support schools, the investment in Canvas is becoming more and more relevant and more important because it really does provide a platform that supports in-person instruction, hybrid instruction, remote instruction, a nimbleness of being able to move between those instructional models, and so we continue to see more districts signing on and going forward in terms of that implementation. We understand that it's difficult to undertake that type of work in the midst of a pandemic, but we also, understood even in the beginning of the summer when we started working on the Canvas platform that the circumstances that we were likely to face would require appropriate deployment of technology, not just internet access and devices in the hands of students, which we've done a lot of work on, but also just organizing instruction so that it can be effective or as effective as possible. So that's continuing to move forward. Another thing that I wanted to talk to you about, I'm trying to remember if this happened before our last meeting, but the Modern States proposal. So We did put out a press release on this, so we were able to negotiate an arrangement with Modern States. They are an organization, a nonprofit organization that offers online instructional opportunities, mostly in the secondary and post-secondary types of environments. We're able to offer those for free to New Hampshire students, including they will pay for up to 1,000 CLEP tests, a lot of talk about assessments, but pay for 1,000 CLEP tests, which we know are accepted at 2,900 colleges and universities around the country, including many of our own university system classes or our institutions. I do appreciate that Helen points out that not all institutions take them, and sometimes they take them and they only give you elective credit, but there's different, you obviously have to look and see what is the credit that can be accepted. But we see that as another good opportunity for students in New Hampshire, particularly students who are learning and working remotely. These are classes that are taught by college professors from places like Columbia and MIT and Tufts. So high quality instructional materials available to our students, available to our educators to integrate and use in their instruction. So we're pretty happy about that. I will tell you that in October, we were one of a few, I don't even know if I can get to a full handful, of states that offered and held SAT, in-school SAT opportunities for our students. As you know, in the springtime, the SAT was for the most part canceled. The SAT is our accountability assessment that we normally offer for students in the spring. There was concern that students who missed that assessment result would maybe never take it. So we offered it to those seniors this fall. So they would have been juniors in the spring taking it, and they were seniors this fall to take it, so that they are now, as I like to say, on the radar for post-secondary institutions. And these are students. So many of our high-performing students might seek out multiple opportunities to take the SAT because they're trying to get the best score they possibly can. We have other students who, if we didn't do that as an in-school opportunity, might not ever take the SAT and might not ever get on the radar to be recruited to a post-secondary opportunity, educational opportunity. And so we're excited to have been able to offer that to them. And so hopefully those students will be getting glossy brochures in their in their mail from colleges across the country, recruiting them because they had the opportunity to take the SAT. So glad, trying to make sure that we keep that equity disparity as tight as possible. We also have been running the New Hampshire SAS. So we created a, what I refer to as a light footprint, assessment. So it is a 30 question assessment in English language arts and a 30 question assessment in mathematics. We were running that principally in the month of October, although there were some schools that needed a longer testing window. So we've extended that testing window, and we still have some other districts that are doing that. This is principally to give schools feedback in terms of how their students are faring. And so what you'll find is when you run it as an accountability assessment, we run third through eighth grade. We actually ran it only fourth through eighth grade. So we actually gave the fourth graders the third grade assessment so that we could see kind of what they carried over from the springtime to see what their learning gaps might be and to understand where that is. So that information is going forward. A lot of the schools have finished that work, and then some are, again, still working on it, just so that you get a sense as to what would be an impediment to the school doing it. Because, again, it's a light-touch assessment. And what I mean by that, it has a smaller footprint. It can be done in between 30 and 45 minutes, depending on the student's time, because it's adaptive, so depending on how many questions a student has to take. But it can also be done remotely. So we set it up with a secure URL, so that if a student's learning remotely, they can still take that assessment. They can just do it at home. And so pretty excited about that and hopeful that we'll get some good information to help inform how we deploy resources in support of all of our schools. Another issue that I wanted to just have some conversation about, I've been having a lot of conversation about it with the districts over the last month and a half, I would guess, at this point in time. And there has been some press around this. Specifically, there was some press I heard on the radio this morning, and I saw something in the Union Leader yesterday, is around the instructional model that schools might be deploying between Thanksgiving and Christmas and perhaps the quarantine period after Christmas. We have had some districts that have made the decision to go remote between Thanksgiving, Christmas, and then plus another 14 or so days after that. So, for example, one of them that I heard recently was from November 30th through January 19th to be fully remote. Part of the driver behind the decision to go fully remote is the fact that you're going to have individuals traveling for Thanksgiving and traveling again for Christmas, and wanted to make sure that we are being as safe as we possibly can. But I have been encouraging districts to think about the flip side of that, and that is oftentimes the travelers are our educators. And so those educators may find themselves in a circumstance where they believe they need to quarantine. And so it would be difficult for the school to actually run the system if the teachers are not able to show up at school for in-person instruction. And so that may be a motivation for going to a remote model of instruction. But the downside associated with that is that many of our families need to go to work, and they don't have the option to work remotely. And so I'm concerned, and I think other people are concerned as well, just that these are families who may find themselves having an economic, already in difficult circumstances, having an additional economic hardship placed on them if they can't work and they can't make any money between Thanksgiving and Christmas, or if they, you know, lose their jobs just before the holidays as well. It could also be difficult for those families. So really just trying to work very closely with the districts to try and find ways to be able to continue to safely provide instruction. One of the areas that we did clarify for the schools, because there was some misunderstanding, is that those who work in the school system are referred to and are qualified as essential workers under all of the state guidelines. And that means that they do not have the same quarantining requirements that a that someone who is not an essential worker would have. So there are conditions that would require them to quarantine, but they have other conditions that would not require them to quarantine. And so just asking schools to look very carefully at those policies before automatically jumping to going fully remote without considering what supports those families might need during that period of time. So I think just an important aspect. Another issue that we have worked a lot on and continue to work on, we've issued technical guidance on this, is around the instructional expectations for our students that are learning, and in particular, making sure that they get support. One of the aspects of that is, you know, we've got a lot of the students who are learning remotely, and then we've got a lot of other students who are learning in a hybrid environment. And so those students, if you're in school, like say on Monday and Tuesday, you're an A cohort, so you're in school on Monday and Tuesday, and they may be working remotely on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, is to just make sure that we have high quality instructional opportunities for those students on those days that they are working remotely. And a part of what we have helped the schools to try and understand is what the definition is of instructional time. And so instructional time in our ED 306-02K says instructional time means the period of time during which pupils are actively working toward achieving educational objectives under the supervision of an educator or another staff member. And so we're trying to be as accommodating as we can for our districts, but we believe that the idea of that supervision of a either under an educator or somebody else in the school system is an important consideration. As we were thinking through this, if you consider students, when they go home at night with homework, they go home, they do their homework. If they get stuck in their homework, the next day they can come into class and they can ask the teacher, hey, I got stuck on these problems, can you help me with them? What we want to make sure is that students always have someone that they can reach out to get support. So we don't want a student who is in class on Monday and Tuesday, and on Wednesday, they log into their Google Classroom, they look at the assignment, and they get stuck, and they don't know how to get unstuck. They need some additional guidance. And so we are encouraging school districts to make sure that there's someone available so that student can reach out. It doesn't have to be their specific classroom teacher, but someone that they can reach out to try and help them get unstuck in the event that they get stuck. And so we have been working with districts because we have had feedback from some parents that feel like their students are in class on Monday and Tuesday, and then they're just sent home, and they don't, the next contact they have with the school is again on Monday the next week, and we don't think that that qualifies as instructional time, and that instructional time means that students have to get support. There, it is, you know, some teachers are doing a great job designing really engaging, enriching curricular opportunities for those students who are in those remote opportunities. We want to make sure that that's the experience for all of our students across the state. So just something that's out there. And then the last thing that I just will point out to you is, I'm not sure if anybody has been checking this out, but we do have a school dashboard that is available now. We are continuing to make changes to it. It is run by Health and Human Services. I can actually, if you go to the Health and Human Services website, you'll see the dashboard, and then there's a tab for the schools. But it is providing a lot of rich information about schools and COVID specifically for those schools. There is a new update that's going to be happening any moment now. I think actually Christine was supposed to happen on Tuesday, but it hasn't happened yet. I checked earlier today. And so what's happening is all of our schools are reporting attendance information on a daily basis and providing information to the dashboard so that you can have a real rich understanding of what's going on in those school environments. I will tell you that part of that required schools to provide Health and Human Services with some information. We've been working with schools to get that information submitted. We were at about 50% after about a month of working with the schools. So we're hopeful that once that becomes transparent, that the schools will get that information out there so that their communities will be able to see kind of what's happening. But it's a good resource in terms of being able to go and see transparently what's happening. And I can tell you that that's going to become more and more apparent, more and more essential as we move into these colder months, increasing case counts here in the state. We are going to be reporting, case counts today that are going to, again, be higher than we are traditionally looking at. Those numbers will be released later today. And it can be disquieting for communities. So a tool like that helps the transparency. And then we are working closely with school leaders across the state. I spend a lot of time on the phone and by email and talking to folks about how to make sure we continually are communicating to our communities to make sure that they understand the mitigating protocols that we have in place to keep people safe, to have a safe instructional environment for our teachers and for our staff and for our students and to protect our families as well. So those are the things I have to share with you today. And I see Helen's got her hand up, so I'll let Drew take it over from there.
Go ahead, Helen.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. That was a really helpful report. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate all the work that the department is doing. And I think something you didn't mention, but that we heard from a number of our speakers today, that they felt like the department is really helping out families with children with disabilities, trying to navigate that with school systems. So I really appreciate that. Separately, you mentioned, and I'm delighted that the SAT was offered again. I think you said it was just offered for seniors. Is that right?
So what we did is we ran in-school SATs, mm-hmm. And we gave first priority to those kids who got it, who missed it in the fall. If right. the district had extra seats, they were more than welcome to be able to fill those.
Okay.
But those students who are juniors this year will have another go at this in the springtime as well.
So at one point, students who took the PSATs and even the SATs, and particularly the PSATs, there was an attempt to identify students, particularly minority students, who might not be registering for those higher level classes, the STEM classes and the AP, particularly AP classes. Is there a substitute mechanism that schools will be able to utilize to try and identify those students and try and get those kids to be able to be encouraged to take those higher level classes?
So we do get specific reports on, I can refer to the AP classes in particular, So we have specific data by school about who is taking those AP classes, and we have some demographic data on that as well. We make that information available to the school, and to in each of the schools there is what's referred to as an AP coordinator. And so make sure that that is available to them so that they can try to make sure that we haven't created artificial barriers that prevent all of our students from accessing some of these really enriching opportunities. So I don't know if that's responsive to your question or not, but that's what we have so far. That's what we do.
Thank you.
I have a question, Commissioner.
Yep.
Just following up on Helen's question about the SATs, do you have on your tip of your tongue the percentage of students that did take the SATs?
So, you know what, let me see if the text came in. The last number I had looked at, so I don't have the most current one. I think I was at like 8,900 students, but that was going back a little bit, and they weren't all reported in yet. So we have a total of about 14,500, high school students that would have been eligible for that. A preliminary number was 8,900, which I was pretty happy about. I mean, I'd like to see it higher, but the 8,900 was not all the schools had even reported in yet. So I know it would go up from there, but I don't know what number we'll get to. We had, there were a couple of schools. So we had three dates that we set, and we had one school that literally got disrupted all three times. So we know they just are not going to be able to get it done. And it was literally circumstances where, they had, COVID incidences in the school that they had to basically pivot on those days, and they were not able to do it. And I don't have infinite flexibility with the SAT like I do with the SAS. Like, College Board gave me three dates. Like, these are your windows. So I had like these, so it was good I got three dates, right? So we said, okay, so we got three chances to try and pull this off. You know, many of the schools obviously were able to pull it off. Some were not able to be successful in that. But we're glad that we got as much done as we could. The SAS is a little bit different because the SAS, I have a whole testing window. That's the New Hampshire SAS for the fourth through eighth graders. And because we created kind of this open URL assessment tool, the schools can take it whenever they want, right? And so they can literally, and they can do it when a kid's on a remote day. They can do it when they're in front of them. And they can do a lot of the things. You know, one of the aspects, like I know there's one school who has an open order for Chromebooks. So the kids are running Chromebooks, but they're older Chromebooks. And these are really old Chromebooks. And so they're working for the Zoom and stuff like that, but they're not, their operating system is so old, it won't run the assessment software. So they're supposed to be getting in their new Chromebooks. They've had them on order since this summer. So we're just leaving that testing window open. When they get them, then they can execute the assessment. Even if they have to go all the way into December to do it, that's fine. So.
Anybody else? All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Open board discussion. Does anybody have anything they want to throw out? Anne.
Yes, I'd like to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving.
We're all going to Sally's.
Yeah.
We're all going to have Thanksgiving at your house. Anybody?
She's muted, so she can't deny it.
Welcome to come on. Well, I don't know. I take that back with the rise of Corona. Jeez. Maybe next year.
Next year. I just.
True.
Helen, is that you?
Yes. I just want to know if we are confirming a date for our second retreat. Are we doing that?
Didn't we already confirm the date? I'm a little hazy on that because I haven't had a lot of time to go back and do the planning. I'm supposed to talk to staff today, but
I don't think we have, Drew, because I've been waiting for a confirmation.
Okay.
Well, we had thrown a date out. I just thought we were going to for sure make sure. I think it was the 29th. Maybe I can look back in my notebook.
Yeah. I don't have that email chain right at the top here.
I don't have anything either.
I don't think it was November 29th.
No, I think it was the 20th. No.
I think it was next week, the 19th maybe.
Yeah, it was like either, it was the week before Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Yep, it was the 19th.
Yeah. And I don't think
It's the 19th. There was, I knew there was a 9 in it. Yep, it was the 19th.
I that's what I had, and I'm still planning to move forward with that. I just got to work with staff. I've delayed the process by not having a lot of time in the last week to work with staff on the agenda and the drafts of the rules that we're going to be working on. So we're going to try to get that going. But if everybody's still good for that date, I think we can go ahead and do it.
I'm going to try. I'm right out straight right now.
Okay.
Do I keep on leaning back and forth? So I'm going to try like hell.
Okay. If anybody has a problem with that date, and I'll email Phil and Cindy to double check with them.
Is there a time? Is it at 9?
I would do the whole, pretty much all day like we did last time. I think we're going to need it.
Okay.
So let's plan on that for now. And then if anybody has an issue with it, let me know.
I think also if you and the staff are not able to fully commit to that, and I certainly understand why, we will have to reschedule, but just want to be sure that you guys have the time and staff has the time they need.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And if we get together and realize it's probably more than we can throw together in a full way so that we're really fully prepared, then we'll just postpone it. I don't want us to go waste our time just winging it.
We'll postpone it, but we'll do it again, right? I don't want to lose track.
Absolutely, it's not going to be a cancellation.
Get really good.
Yeah, I think we made a lot of progress, but so we'll definitely do it. We'll shoot for next Thursday. I'll let you know ASAP if that has to be postponed.
Okay.
Question.
Relative to the charter school. Grant money that was allocated to New Hampshire but was denied by the legislature. Now that that composition has changed, what is the status of that?
I would turn that to the commissioner. It's unchanged right now.
So it remains unchanged at this point in time. I did earlier this week had a conversation with Representative Wallner, who chairs the fiscal committee, and asked her if she wanted me to bring that to the November committee meeting. She didn't think that she did, but that she would let me know. And if not, then we will bring it again in December.
Okay. anybody else? I just wanted to throw out just as a clarification for, or an amplification for the parents we heard from today on the remote instruction rule, that we as a board hear you, and the department I know has fielded a lot of complaints from parents about the challenges of remote instruction, particularly from parents who have children with IEPs. It's a real issue, and everybody's aware of it. And so I want everybody to understand that it's not being taken lightly or dismissed.
And if I might comment as well, because we have received a number of complaints, but there's a number of schools as well. And I think we even heard from, I think Carrie was one of the moms who, the schools are a lot of schools are trying as well. Like, so they're in a remote model. So normally this child would only be in the school for 2 days a week, but they're bringing that child in 5 days a week, even though on some of those days it's limited amounts of time in school, to try and find a way to get the services that need to be gotten in person, right? So so I want to recognize that they are trying to do that in a lot of cases as well.
And we're not the only state, Frank. Wisconsin, my daughter has a disabled child. She needs a he needs a speech. He needs all of it. And we're not the only state that's going through this. And I think
it's nationwide. I mean, if you,
I think he's done a great job, all of us.
If there's a lot of stories from around the country of this same thing. It's certainly not exclusive to New Hampshire. And I think
it's everywhere.
You know, to go back to what Chas Miller said at the beginning of our meeting, that running a school is, there's a lot of moving parts and it can be a lot more complex than people realize. And, you know, remote instruction, when you have kids with special needs who require in-person, help, assistance, that's a real challenge. So not to downplay the challenge, but we hear the parents too. And that's all I had. All right. Well, we have no old business. Consent agenda, the meeting minutes. Okay. I thought these meeting minutes were, yes, Kate, go ahead.
Capital City, did I miss that? Did we have an update on that?
We do not have an update. Okay. I'm hoping to do an update next month.
Okay. We all know that's my favorite subject.
Yeah, that's the leftover table item for the request.
Okay.
True.
And you know what? We could actually probably take that off. Yeah, Helen?
Couple of things. I had some typos, I think, in the minutes, but what are we doing about Bonnie's email that said she thinks that her comments were inaccurately represented?
Yeah, I think, Angela, did she send you the text, right?
Yes, I actually reached out to her and asked if she was okay with just amending it with what she had emailed everyone.
Yeah.
I circled back and heard from her just a little while ago, and she confirmed yes, please. So I've already inserted that new, the amended language in her testimony. So it's now in the minutes. So.
Okay.
And any other changes, I'm not going to, obviously it won't be finalized until I hear the other amendments that may need to be made or typos.
Helen, go ahead.
So page 5060.
Okay.
Second paragraph, second line. I think that's supposed to be end of course, not end of court. Much as though that sings to me, I think it's end of course.
End of course. Where are you? 5060. Oh, you know what? I bet it moved. I will find that.
That's what the number is at the top of the page.
Yeah, you know what happened, Helen, is I've already inserted the changes from,
moved
everything around a little bit. It's all good. I'll find it.
For a hint, it's Nicole's, it's where Nicole was speaking. It was her testimony, so it's there, you know, and there's another one, same thing.
Court plays it. Yep, I'll find it. I can find it.
Yeah, second paragraph. Second line. Okay, Helen, others?
I think on 5061, sorry, that's just the next page. It's the second paragraph, finally, by replacing the competency assessment. I think that may have been she was talking about evaluation with assessment. By replacing the competency assessment. I thought what she had been saying, evaluation with competency assessment, maybe.
I think you're right, Helen. I think that's not quite, I think that's too truncated.
Right. It's just a little too shortened from what she was saying.
Angela, do you think that's possible to just go back and listen to that moment?
Oh, definitely. I think that's no problem.
Yeah, I think that's not quite what she was saying.
Right.
That's all I had.
Anybody else?
Yes, Drew, Ann.
Yeah, go ahead.
The next paragraph down from where Helen was, if you could also listen to see if there's anything more there, because that also is kind of, I made some comment and her response doesn't seem quite related.
I'll check.
But on page 5080,
scrolling down. Give me a minute.
Me too.
Oh, it's really down here. Okay, hold on.
At the very end. Last paragraph where Drew's following up on something I said, and then the sentence reads, school districts are already suffering financially and the board needs to address the issue.
Yeah. That's-
yes, I see that. It's
It would be really cool if we could. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get out my piggy bank.
Strike that? Is that the?
I don't remember what was said, but that doesn't seem to.
I'll highlight it and go back because it sounds like it's out of context too. So.
That's all I have.
I have a couple. On 5057. The second paragraph, the last sentence.
Hold on, let me just go find this.
57.
So what does it start with? Just because things have moved down.
The paragraph starts with Chairman Klein sympathized.
Okay. Huh. What was the page number again, Drew? I'm sorry.
5057. It's right near the top.
Yeah, Okay, I can find it at some point. I just can't see it.
It's right above the motion. The next paragraph is motion for Kate Cassidy making the motion for the...
I see it. I got it. Thank you.
So the last sentence in that graph, so where the last sentence above where it says motion... Mm-hmm. It says the family was encouraged to switch their daughter to in-person learning so she can be more educationally challenged. I do not recall that was done. That does not seem accurate to me.
Okay, I'll highlight it and just see. That's good.
And then going down to 5064.
Okay.
All right. So starting with, let me find it. So it was the last paragraph on that page. Chairman Klein expressed concern that requested changes did not fully address and so forth.
I found it.
So the second sentence there.
The curriculum?
Yeah.
Okay.
The curriculum of the social justice class should include more emphasis on legal aspects of the IEP. I don't think exactly what I was saying. My bigger point, and I can give you a sentence there, but maybe it's worth going back and checking.
I'm going to go back and check. It seems like there's a lot of, because these are summarizations and I don't know. I'll go back and
My criticism was that I had concerns that UNH had problems getting students to learn basic skills necessary for the job, yet they had time and resources to offer a social justice advocacy class. It wasn't quite
worth saying. Yeah.
That the class itself should incorporate the legal stuff. That's not really what I was saying.
Okay. I think it's worth going back and just checking it out, to be honest with you.
And I don't know if they used it. It seems like they used a different transcriber for this one because the last
one. Yeah, I think they did. So I'm going to go back.
And very thorough and detailed. And this one was extremely truncated. And I think the transcriber got some stuff wrong. Anybody else? Okay. How about a motion?
Motion to adjourn.
No, the minutes.
Sorry. Motion to accept the minutes as modified.
I'll second it, Helen.
Okay. Roll call.
All right. Kate Cassidy.
Yes.
Ann Lane.
Yes.
Sally Griffin.
Yes.
Helen Honoreau.
Yes.
Drew Klein.
Abstain.
What time is it? 12. I do have an update. This, how do you guys like this format?
Good.
Much better.
So we have a temporary license right now through the end of December, and hopefully it'll will extend this beyond. But if you're, you know, when you did the retreat last time, we kind of borrowed VLAXs, so we can actually, I can work with Nate and Caitlin and you, Drew, on setting this same thing up for the retreat if it's next week.
Yeah.
And I can either be there too or give hosting duties over to Nate. He seemed to really enjoy it.
He was doing a great job. Look, I mean, my preference, and I've heard this from other members, is the soonest we can get back to in person, we want to do that. So
yeah.
I know that would be preferable, but this is definitely preferable to the phone.
Oh, yeah, I can do my hair. I look at my glasses. I make this. Nobody reacts.
Love the glasses. Love them. Love them.
Got them.
Oh, this is great. Okay, good. I just wanted to let you know what. So we have this, and hopefully we can continue this until we can meet back in person.
And I think, does anybody want to take up a motion to require Phil to bring the baby to the next meeting?
Yeah.
At least an appearance, right?
Yes. And so we're doing a Zoom meeting. I think he's got to have baby on the lap for the whole meeting. That'd be my recommendation. Okay, motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
That was Kate.
Okay. Second. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Yeah, yeah, same to you.
Thanks, everybody.
Oh, but we're going to see you before Thanksgiving, right?
We
hope.
Oh, yeah. Happy week before Thanksgiving. Bye.
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 Helen.
Oh, roll call. Hey. Sally?
Yes.
Ann?
Yes.
Kate?
Yes.
Drew?
Yes.
All right, I think we already lost Helen, so.
I'll say yes for Helen.
Okay.
All right, sorry.
All right,
bye. Be well.
Bye. Well.